I know you're calling me, I know that I know you. I really think the drain on our energy and time, those of us who live in a civilized time like Peter Maravillam Sidrufi. I left Acacia Park at 5 to 8. For 25 minutes we couldn't move because you can't go out to Bandar Drive because the traffic is just. And I have consistently campaigned for Parliament to be moved to Pietermaritzburg. And I really think you should prosecute these Cape Town-based people for all the pain they caused those of us. It's a beautiful city, but it just doesn't work. Okay, and not because the DA is running it, let me say. May I welcome everybody. We're going to have, I'm told, the DSO first. Okay, so shall we go for that now? We've got
1, 2, 3, 4. Sorry?
It's a DSO, needless to say. You better watch every word you say. JB Sibanyoni is in Swanee, is that right? And then there's, Mr. Miruti won't be here. She's got a women's big meeting, PC meeting, with the NEC at Kimberley. And then there's the first person.
Testing 1, 2, 3, 4, 5.
And of course, Van der Berg of the IMP is not here. Thank you very much. Okay, thank you. I can hear that at that point. Okay. Thank you, Chairperson. I'm accompanied by Advocate Mwengwe on my right. He said I must please ask you whether we could move Parliament to Cato Ridge, where he stems from. That's an awfully civilized place. I doubt that. Chair, we went here last year and we made a similar presentation, so I'll try and be as succinct as possible. I have put up the structure before. I'll just repeat again very briefly that when we set up the 1, 2, 3, 4, 5. Yeah, I must warn you. No problem. But look, we can live with that. It's not the end of the world.
Sharon Graham?
Okay. I'm afraid I don't know. This is Parliament. This is how it is. When we initially set up the DSO, we thought we'll have a lean and mean structure. We now have 813 posts that you count in those structures. We try to separate strategy from operations. And in the process, we created somewhat of a bureaucracy. That is all well-intended, Chairperson. We're looking at ways of making it lean and streamlining it. You see that there are 5 project teams in Gauteng, Eastern Cape, Western Cape, KwaZulu-Natal, and the Free State.
This one, 2, 3, 4. Six, 1, 2. Six, 1, 2.
I'll have tea with the imam after the chairperson. If members of the Scorpions wake me up at 4 in the morning and ask me what my key thinking is about the work that
I'm doing, I'm going
to be able to answer them.
Chi. Chakwan Chi. Chakwan Chi. Testing 1-2.
Mantra.
Chakwan Chi. Testing 1-2.
Yeah, the answer is that we target criminals and organized crime and profit from it. And a lot of thought has gone into that key message in the work that we do. Because it assists us to target the top echelons of organized crime and really look at those instances where people profit from crime in a big way. So that we can design our strategy to impoverish them and prosecute them effectively. And get them in prison in some of these big cases. As has often been said, the GSO uses a multidisciplinary approach to deal with cases more effectively under a central command structure. My own view is that it is a very good strategy. It has worked effectively in South Africa for the last 7 years. And then thirdly, we strive to be more proactive and preemptive and intelligent and investigating and prosecuting organized crime. I often use the phrase when I describe this by saying we're trying to get to the accident before it happens, which is a difficult thing. You speak to people internationally, many law enforcement prosecuting authorities have voiced their opinion that it's very difficult, that in many of these big corporate cases you can only come and mop up after the event. And then finally, Chairperson, as I said, we target the top end of organized crime. We look at the main perpetrators and syndicates, and we focus on the proceeds of priority crimes through calculated court work. Yeah, I just wish to pause and say that it's an area where I think the DSO could be doing much better, the area of court work, because we can investigate as effectively and successfully as we could. But if the results of our work are not felt in court, then it is rather superfluous. The next slide just sets out a comparative analysis of our performance for the last 4 years. The chairperson will note that there is a slight drop in investigations finalized and in prosecutions finalized. But in other areas, we've done fairly well. You look at assets under restraint, 550 million. It does not include the restraint order in the UK. As in regard to the David King case, I'm very happy to announce that the GSO members have seized contraband to the value of more than 1 billion rand. These are precursor substances and drugs in the Western Cape, KwaZulu-Natal and Johannesburg. The conviction rate has been about 85%, Chairperson, but I wouldn't want to insult the intelligence of the committee. That indicator is really taken far too much. Too far in the public domain. It's not really a success indicator if you look at it in isolation, because the GSO has the ability to select its cases. And if you use people from probably five different disciplines to investigate a case from the start and plan its prosecution strategy and marshal all the evidence, then the chances that you will succeed is fairly high. I might also add, Chairperson, that probably 25% of our cases are cases that are disposed of through plea bargaining. And so I think the 86% while it's good on the face of it, you must take into account these factors that I've just mentioned. The drop in investigations finalized and prosecutions finalized, I'd like to say that it's really attributable to three factors. First, the cases are getting much more involved. The investigations are complex. It's not easy to wade through them. Probably 25% of the cases have an international dimension. And in probably 50% of cases, we have to do forensic auditing work, which further delays the process. That's the first reason. The second reason is that we are often crowded out of courts. There was a time 3 years ago where we motivated that we should have dedicated courts for the scorpions, but it was felt that it wouldn't be sustainable. And so you are dependent on time in the court role given to you by those people who run the courts. The third factor is, Chairperson, we are an organization that's still in creation to a large extent. I mean, if you look at the history of the FBI and other agencies like Scotland Yard, they've been around for 60, 40 years. Although what is portrayed in the public mind is that you have this group of very effective people, highly skilled, we are not where we should be in terms of skill levels. We don't have enough advocates to do many of these big cases, and I would like to attribute the drop in performance in those two areas to the fact that we need stronger and better people, investigators and advocates. Chairperson, I'm not going to spend time too much on the key activities. It is in the annual report. Just a highlight there, 368 new investigations, 317 suspects arrested, and 316 sites searched. Those searches are necessary and effective, and I'd like to say in this committee that we find that in probably 85% of the searches, you get information that is relevant and useful to explaining the merits of any investigation and prosecution. The assets under restraint, as I said, if you add the James King case, is close to 1.5 billion rand. Those assets, the restraint orders are found in 25 court orders here and internationally. The GSO has handled 41 cases, from which 64 million is just trying to go into the criminal asset recovery fund. Of course, we are delayed there by the role of the curators in getting these orders out of the way as soon as possible. And then just the last bullet there, Chairperson, we put that up as one of our strategic objectives is to repatriate money to the victims of organized crime. And in some of the cases we did in the reporting period 2006 to 2007, 50 million rand were given back to the victims of organized crime. Yeah, I just wanted to give the committee a sense of the difficulty of the cases we're dealing with. Now, the Legionnaire case is a case in the Cape that I'm sure members of Parliament have followed with great interest. It's one of the five biggest corporate collapses that South Africa faced in the last 5 years. I would personally venture to say that the collapse of JGI and Randgold and exploration in the Chemo matter could very well be our own version of Enron. But I wouldn't want to preempt things because prosecutions will flow from that particular case. The Sambo Bank is up in court at the moment. And I really want to just again explain the complexity of that case. I'm told that the judge remarked at some point in the lead-up to the evidence of the forensic auditor that he should start from the beginning because he had some difficulty following it. The Fidentia case is of equal importance. Many ministers in government have commented about the fact that 10 years later, they worry that South Africa has not developed a regulatory authority to prevent collapses like Fidentia. Chairperson will probably know that recently we prosecuted one of the people who was so overwhelmed by the merits of the case that he pleaded guilty, agreed to a 15-year sentence, and paid back 6 million rand to the curators, and offered to testify against the other parties in this matter. The other cases are typical organized crime cases. The Agriotti case, I'm sure everyone knows about it. We're still struggling to get Billy Rosenbach back to South Africa chairperson. This is a problem with mutual legal assistance. We've asked for his extradition, and the Zimbabwean authorities are considering it. The Shea case, you will know that we were very lucky to win it in the Supreme Court of Appeal on the merits, as well as the searches, and subsequently in the Constitutional Court. The NPA is in the Constitutional Court again today on the asset forfeiture side, and we'll probably know later today or tomorrow which way the court is thinking. Chairperson, there's a case that I'd like to mention. It's a mastermind case. It's a smuggling case. It's a typical cigarette smuggling case, but it's one of five cases where the NPA took an unusual strategy. You see, when we prosecute, we must find in our own mind first that there is a reasonable prospect of a conviction. Here, because some of the people were from Rwanda, some were from Europe, there was a difficulty in putting all the files together and putting out a decent tax case. Their counsel approached us to say that they don't think we'll be able to prove our case effectively against two of the directors in South Africa. But what they offered in return was to pay money into the criminal asset recovery account pursuant to a order under Chapter 6 of the Prevention of Organized Crime Act. We had to consider this matter very carefully because we didn't want to be seen to be bought off by criminals. And I think it's a criticism that's often, or that might be labeled against us, that you take money in return for freedom. We agreed to take 33 million rand in this matter. It went to a judge in the High Court. We disclosed everything we had to disclose. We couldn't give the parties an indemnity, but we decided not to prosecute the matter. I'm raising the chairperson because I think there's work that could be done by this committee to look at instances where one could use provisions similar to the SEC rules in the U.S. It's a Security and Exchange Commission, where in some of these big commercial cases, they issue something similar to civil forfeiture fines. It's a rare and difficult call to make, but I do think it's very, very useful. I've just been talking to people in the U.S. In the last 2 weeks, and they've sent me some material and some statistics on the use thereof, and I can avail it to the committee. We've done it now in three cases in the last 2 years, and I can also maybe send the papers to the committee so that the committee can apply their minds to it. So I just wanted to give a more graphic illustration of the Red Cross case. It is probably one of our lucky cases. You know, sometimes you get lucky. We just got information. We did the surveillance that led to a raid in the warehouse here in Milnerton in Cape Town and found that the accused packed about 4 tons of cannabis and hashish amongst boxes of apples to a street value of about 364 million. That was in July 2006. Within a year, they were all convicted and sentenced to combined 23 years, 1.6 million rand fines imposed. Maybe we should have done more work on the money that they have, but I have been talking to people from the Serious Organized Crime Agency in the UK, and they're looking at how they can interdict funds in the UK. This is a success story, Chairperson. It really punched a hole in the drug market here in the Western Cape. We did, when we were here last year, invite members of the committee to come and witness the burning of the drugs because it has a therapeutic value and size to it. I think 2 members arrived. I hope they left there not feeling too dazed, but this stuff does affect you when you inhale it. The Cape Town Scorp is very appropriately called it Operation Red Cross. But there you see the drugs, and I thought I'd just share that with the committee very briefly. Thank you. So the matter that I really want to focus on is the phishing case, which is really amounts to an email attack on financial systems. interesting thing about this case is that the emails were distributed indiscriminately to South African email users from Canada. With a controller site in Canada, you'll see how the lines come through under item 2, item line number 3, multiple posting sites in Australia, Taiwan, and India, and Israel. And then, of course, unsuspecting or greedy or gullible investors, in brackets, responded by giving their details in response to these advances and thereby initiating transactions that ended up in money being withdrawn in ATM machines in Russia. It's a very complex case, Chairperson. We prosecuted 3 people in South Africa. They're all in jail. They're just computer junkies, with respect. That's part of the syndicate based in South Africa. We worked with Standard Bank quite effectively, and we're now working with international partners in Europe, in the US, and Canada to take this thing to the next level. But I'm not an expert in this area, but when I looked at what one of our advocates, Paul Lowe, put up in one of his presentations to us, I really expressed the concern that if this thing is not checked and watched properly, one might face serious risk on your financial system and your computer systems in future. I know that especially in Canada and the US, they're really busy overhauling the regulatory systems and the use of computers and its link to the financial system. I don't want to say too much about Operation Bad Guys. It's been in the press for all the wrong reasons. I respect the sub judice principle. But again, it's been one of our successful cases. Chapters are not so much for the prosecution, but the ability to take drugs off the street. I think it resonates in the public mind very well that one's been able to take drugs off the street. It's, as I said, a rather messy case, and I'd rather let the judges decide on who's guilty and who's not. Just on international assistance, I know that we're often in the spotlight for the wrong reasons, but you can't fight organized crime and deal with the big financial crime cases and with grand corruption cases unless you have good relations with international institutions. In this case, we work with the FBI, Mozambican authorities, the European Anti-Fraud Office, the Serious Fraud Office, the International Criminal Court, Scotland Yard, and the like. And we probably had about 60 mutual legal assistance requests in the last year ongoing between us and these different authorities dealing with offshore investments, transfer pricing, corrupt and nominal shareholding, and of course, extradition. Chairperson, we get very good money from this government. I don't think the Scorpions can complain. Our people are well paid. We have an ENE of $364 million, I understand, it's been hiked up by 15% until 2010. We use our budget prudently. I think we can do with better financial management. We probably overspend by 5% in that particular financial year. We still pay for shared services within the NBA, and you see that we spend $210 million for that. I was joking with the CFO yesterday and said, are we still subsidizing the NPA? But I'm sure we'll be able to give an account for our money. We haven't had money stolen from within the DSO in that particular financial year, which is quite positive. And finally, on the human resources front, there are at present, or at the time of this, the close of that financial year, we had 509 positions filled. We are presently 537 staff as chairperson. Even on present ratios, we have 53% African, 28% white, 8% Indian, and 11% colored. And males still dominate by 64% and females by 36%. These are, by the way, all South African citizens. They're all from this country. Of our investigators, 94% are graduates. Some have 2 or 3 degrees, and I would like to believe they're just good citizens. In our presentations, we were asked to just focus on some key lessons. I'd like to just highlight probably 3, Chairperson. The first one is that there is a real need for us to apply ourselves and make less mistakes in the law, and because that's what the business we're in. We're not running a post office. And then when we investigate and prosecute these difficult cases, is to prosecute them to the end, despite all the challenges that one faces, with great efficiency. The second point I'd like to make is that, as a country, I think we need to invest much more in unraveling corporate crimes. And I'm talking particularly about prosecutors. I don't think generally our prosecution standards are where they should be. I often joke and say there are very few bloody downers in the NPA. But our experience for the last 5 years is prosecutors must do much more to understand the way to deal with the evidence of agents, to understand the chemistry of syndicates, and to follow financial trails in organized crime cases. I think the world is a little bit ahead of us. And then finally, Chairperson, just because of something that can be toxic, in applying indemnities and plea bargaining and using the provisions of the Prevention of Organized Crime Act, we should act probably a bit more judiciously. I know that the NDPP has asked that we have standardized guidelines throughout the NPA to regulate plea bargaining. We recently charged someone with racketeering in a corruption case, and someone bumped into me at the airport and said, "Are you calling him Al Capone? Are you equating him with Al Capone?" Because the Americans used the RICO statute for the first time when they prosecuted Al Capone. So one has to develop the law in this area and use the Prevention of Organized Crime Act and its provisions in the right cases. So the lessons learned from our previous year that has influenced our strategic plan for this year, probably three key things, is to get the right mix between, you know, we've learned a lot from other countries, and interestingly, some other countries have dumped the business approaches used by corporations in South Africa, but the NPA has decided to strike a balance between delivery, governance, and resourcing. In the DSO, people are saying, okay, governance is important, resourcing is important, but we have to produce. So we have structured our plan in such a way that there's a greater emphasis on achieving the delivery targets. I know that we have been criticized by some people in the organization about that, but I can defend it. I'd rather want to come to Parliament and say we've achieved our core delivery objectives in the last year as opposed to telling you about how many cars we have and that they've been used only for the right purposes. The second thing, Chairperson, about those key lessons is that I think all institutions in the country should place a much greater emphasis on compliance, risk management, internal integrity, and systems platform. It's often said that the one distinguishing characteristic of a democracy is that when you leave systems behind. The Scorpions have about 38 policies, and I would be lying to the Chairperson if I say that our compliance levels are above 80%. And in an ideal world, they should be 100%. I'm also concerned about the internal integrity within the organization. There are still people who speak out of turn to the wrong people. Chairperson will notice that in the last 6 months, I haven't said a word in the media. I only speak twice. I speak when I'm in this house, and I speak when I have to file affidavits in court. Otherwise, I don't think the government pays me to talk to the media and have coffee and tell them about my life. The third issue that I think it's important from a development and legal skills point of view is to settle the jurisprudence in the Prevention of Organized Crime Act. We have very few cases dealing with the new Corruption Act. The Scorpions have, in 17 cases, subpoenaed people to come and answer and explain their wealth in terms of Section 23 and 24 of the new Corruption Act. That's a brilliant act. We have law enforcement authorities in this country are just not using it. And we're still struggling to get the right results in letters of request and foreign restraint orders. And as I said to Chairperson, what is of concern to me is that in the cases that the GSO is dealing with at the moment, and there are 405 cases resulting from about 315 projects, that 25% of those cases have an international dimension. So you end up investigating offshore. And I think it's an area where we really need to upgrade our skill level. And Chairperson, of course, finally, to strike a balance between qualitative and quantitative targets. You will notice that the feedback that I've given you is probably more at a quantitative level. And maybe it's something that this committee can help us with. When we were here last year before you took office, we engaged with the committee and there was actually some suggestion that we should come back here and in a closed session sit with the committee, and the committee can say to us, now, how did you get to a target of 250 cases? Can't you measure it differently? And unfortunately, that hasn't happened. I would still, if possible, like to do that with the committee. And finally, just on our challenges, you know, the art of a good organization is if you find Coca-Cola in Cape Town, Coca-Cola in Durban, Coca-Cola in Johannesburg, all look and taste the same. Not always, but it's fairly predictable. So I think as a prosecuting authority, and particularly the DSO, that there are pockets of excellence in the organization, and one should really strive to standardize that best practice. The second thing is the former minister, deceased Minister of Justice, Mr. Omar, once called me out of a meeting and said he's just been talking to President Mandela, who said to him that they must tell us that the emphasis should be on the courts number one, the courts number two, and the courts number three. And I don't think the DSO has punched above its weight in the courts. I'd like to, whichever way things go, reserve more dedicated court time to deal with these big cases and get them prosecuted as speedily as possible. Jefferson, because of the complexity of case and all the legal points taken by clever counsel, we really need to hold an in-house counsel capacity to defend us in these big cases. The last 2 points more for our staff, because they've been doing very good work. The majority of them, 95% of them, are good people who want to serve this country. I thought in that particular year it was important that in the new year we enhance the workspace to make it more equitable, more competitive, and more rewarding for them. You know, the difficulties it's often assumed that if you're in the public service and you're part of a large bureaucracy, then it's okay to be average. What we wanted to do is to encourage people to compete, to perform well, and to reward them. And then, of course, Jefferson, very important to finally for the Scorpions to find new work, new trophies, new victories, and new success. I think it's worrying if the organization is associated with 3 or 4 or 5 cases every time you think of it. The fact is there's very good work going on in many projects which are just not, we just don't come out in the public domain. And then finally, Jefferson, because although I'm a cynic, I love philosophy, I thought I'll end off with David Weinbaum's quote about victories often occur after you see no way to succeed, but refuse to give up anyway. Thank you very much.
Dion, Dr. Telford, and then if Imam, Mishlawe, Carol. Can I just point out, Bulalani, our WIP is in a meeting of WIPs at the moment, because normally we start at 10, and then John Jeffrey is caught up in a meeting and he'll be late. Thank you.
Thank you, Chair. And as I indicated last week, when the other units gave presentations, I commended them on the great successes and that they had achieved, and I wanted similarly on your record, again, commend the Scorpions on a very, very exemplary record. The MPA advocate, Rudy Piccoli, stated in his report that the MPA has had to endure severe pressure and moral drain and battering in recent years. And I'm sure that you would probably far more so have experienced that, and maybe you can just touch on that and the how that has impacted your morale can I then also just ask you more specifically about the issue of fishing? Now, I was a victim of fishing, not for any greed or anything, but I had a genuine letter from my bank that for all intents and purposes looked like that, and I punched information in that resulted in certain things being taken from my account, which was quite amazing. Can you just clarify that further? I reported it, and very little has happened. It seems to be widespread, but I get at least 2 emails per day that would appear to be from banks that I'm involved with. But clearly I ignored them. I was silly enough to have responded in the first regard. If you could just respond to that. And thirdly, you referred to the issue of communication, communicating your image. I think we had a very lengthy discussion on this issue last week, the image of the NPA and how to communicate that better, and I think that, Chair, we might need to engage that a bit more in a bit more detail. Thank you.
I think you take all these questions because they're quite loaded, and then I'll come to you. I'll let it overlap with what Steve said.
Chairperson, I probably come from a different school, but you know, as we sit here, this man here, I call him Zita, from Cato Ridge, they are in the Constitutional Court today. I've just been sitting on the plane last night going through a training manual that has been drafted by 11 very industrious people. There's a project in the Eastern Cape involving major organized crime commodities that I think will probably change the face of the Eastern Cape as it comes together. There are prosecutions underway here. Our operational support people are at work. And I'd like to encourage that. I don't believe in negativity. We went around the country from the 30th of January till the 7th of February. We spoke to all the staff. We're considering their input about a whole host of matters. We're acting judiciously and in a sober manner, acknowledging that we don't have a monopoly of wisdom over what is right. But at the same time, my message to the staff is that you have to work because we're getting paid for it. It's a very rewarding position that you have. And I think that we were made to work. That's just me personally. People must work, otherwise it does something to their psyche. So I spread a positive message. I take the best out of what people do. I commend them when I see them doing well despite difficulties. This is a tough environment. It is not, as I said, it's not a post office. I hate to use the standard response of the Americans, when they say, if you can't take the heat, get out of the kitchen. But of course, people are in a situation where they're concerned about their future and their careers. But it's not, I don't know, I wouldn't like to think that it's something that drives us to a point where people want to cut their risks. My message to them is that you always have a job if you work and you deserve it. You always get paid. We can't reduce your salary. And you'll also have a security of tenure, and we can't reduce your status. But that means, Chairperson, I probably work with the wrong people, but I think it's a kiss of death to join the noises about people are down in the dumps. I just don't think it's good for this country. I really don't think so. So to answer Mr. Swart's question, yes, it has an impact, but it's not the overriding consideration. We've got good people who are continuing with their work every day, and I'm very proud of them. Secondly, the fishing example, this is what's happening when you don't build insulation systems around the mechanisms that they have in the banks. So we have a team of people who are now working with the Banking Council and with all the major banks in South Africa. We've also asked to engage Treasury in this matter. I think it is maybe something that we could have more discussions on about over the telephone, or you could probably arrange that you speak to some of the experts here in the Cape Town office. But it is worrying if you say that you're getting two of these things from your own bank on a weekly basis, and it looks genuine, and you've reported and nothing gets done about it. It is for me a sort of concern where I hear that people on my left are using the internet and the credit card for transactions. I refuse to do that. I go to the bank like my mother and pay my bills. And then, yes, the image issue is important. You know, I want to just touch on something. Often, we decide to charge someone, and then the evidence about what we allege is contained in the charge sheet. Now, that's in the public domain. Well, often, there are motion applications, and we have to respond to what other people allege. And then that is in the public domain. That's the first category of communication. The second category of communication is when the NPA decides themselves to communicate something up front. And I think that's why Chairperson, I'm still hoping that we can have this closed session where we can speak about these things. Because I do think if you look at the NPA with the benefit of 2020 vision, that we've made some mistakes in the past. And as I said, maybe I'm just a bit too conservative, but I don't believe in this announcing a decision before it's going to happen. Sometimes you write to the attorneys and say we want to prosecute your client, and when the client goes to court and the charge is served upon him and the client appears, then it's okay if that becomes public. Sometimes there's a public interest angle where like the Fidentia case, Chairperson. I was called about the Fidentia case last February and asked, are you investigating it? I discussed it with Mr. Piccoli, I discussed it with the Ministry of Finance staff, and they said, look, here is a rare case where you have to say, yes, we are. Because it affects the public, it's a corporate collapse, much of the evidence is already with the curators. The public needs to be assured, and people looking at South Africa from the outside would want to know that the law enforcement authorities are dealing with this matter. But that should be the exception. The fourth category, Mr. Swart, is that other people also have the same information. There's a matter now, and I don't want to mention the name of the company, I just received a report last night, where three forensic reports were done internally by a parastatal and two by forensic firms that have no relationship with us. So now we're starting our work, and so there is a risk there that that information could reach the public domain without any role played by the DSO or the NPA. And maybe that is also an area where the committee could bring out some regulatory provisions. I know that in the Comparator Commission, one of the recommendations was that we also vet service providers. And I've been talking to the Bar Council, and of course they would have great difficulty with advocates being vetted and having their accounts looked at before they start working for us. So it's about balance in the way you engage with those things. But more importantly, Chairperson, I don't think we're doing one-tenth as a country of what we can do in terms of proper communication. Many people don't know exactly what the DSO does, the relationship between business units, the core business of the NPA, and the real success stories of people being prosecuted every day, great courageous stories by prosecutors who stand up for justice. Mr. Michel knows that I often have this debate with him, that there should be a communication person here in Cape Town and all the other provinces that goes to the court and report those good stories. That's what my mother wants to hear. Not only all these other cases we often hear about. Thank you, sir.
These issues are... We welcome Llewellyn Landis, alternate member of our committee, and once again express our condolences. The committee last week collectively decided on that, and I'm going to be writing to you, which I'll do in the next 24 hours. Welcome back, Llewellyn. He lost his father very recently, and he... wish him well in difficult circumstances. Just the people want to pick up on the issues just raised. I know one of the people who would is not here, so I speak for him, but also as a chair, to be fair, I should raise these issues. One is, you see, we write a report on all the entities that appear before us, and as far as possible, we try to carry some of our conclusions through the processing of the report while you're here. Now, I think we're not going to cover the ground we covered last week at the Kingdom Chair. It was a bit unfortunate that the press, I don't think, deliberately focused on the one side, which is to say that it is our view that the NP, and the PSO in particular, must take responsibility for its own problems too. But we also feel it's not in the long-term interest of this country that the NPA be constantly undermined.
Yeah.
And we will in our report, I'm alerting members to this, probably say something to the effect that we think that without intruding on your autonomy and consistent with the Constitution and with the necessary and relevant legislation, the minister should exercise supervision come oversight more effectively. In terms of the Constitution, you're answerable to her without her intruding on your autonomy, obviously. NP as a whole, but obviously the PSO. We also think that you're accountable to Parliament in terms of the PSMA and your performance targets and your use of the budget and so on. And I think we as a committee communicated last week, and Willie Hofmeyer, and I think as can share on your behalf, the NP as a whole, said fine. We will be more activistic in our role.
Yeah.
In respect of the specific commitment this committee made when I was in chair, that committee's commitment remains. Whether I'm the chair, whether I'm going to Mongolia tomorrow or not is irrelevant. But the problem is that you might have heard through the public domain, this year is going to be an especially difficult year because parliamentary sittings are going to be quite limited. Effectively, like in all parliaments anywhere in the world, the second half of this year, given that elections are pending, is an election year. And MPs are normal, you're MPs like everywhere else in the world today. We're not freedom fighters anymore. But we are, in a manner of speaking, we like to delude ourselves. We are in the same way we were before 1994. But the truth is, like MPs, we are concerned to get re-elected, and we will be sort of dissipating in Parliament. Even the committee sits here. I dread to think beyond the Cape Town-based people, how many people will be here. But can we note in our report, Caroline, Carol, Lolly, not Carol, Christine, Sue Ann, that we will seek, within the constraints of time and other considerations, to meet with the NPA, I mean the DSO and the NPA, in a closed session to look at how you decide on target. On the issue of the media, I had Advocate and Shea last week, and Willie Hofmeyer, and I hear you today. Personally, I'm not convinced, you know. I think Willie gave quite a cogent reply and explained the extent to which you are going to monitor your own staff to see they do not leak. And he explained that, in fact, what appears in court is often substantially different from what is leaked in the media. Much of that may be true, but I remain unconvinced that you are doing enough to deal with the media leaks. Particularly, as I said last week, and it relates mainly to the DSO, because of the pernicious consequences it has, especially if you do not proceed with cases. People's family lives are destroyed and so on. Page one of the city press said, you know, you can't, it is irreparable damage. And there's no doubt in my mind, I think myself, members of CETA contested, that in some or other measure these leaks are coming from the DSO. And what you offer to Parliament is not convincing enough. And in our report to Parliament, we can say the majority in the committee, to acknowledge that maybe the opposition members don't agree. And we can note the disagreement. In committees that I've chaired, we've noted minority party views. The majority in the committee, I think, I don't know if I speak for the ANC, people speak for themselves in a moment, because this is processing the work. I'm just alerting the researchers to the issues they'd like raised. The majority of us feel that you're not doing enough. And actually, it doesn't serve justice. It's just not fair. It victimizes people. But on the other hand, we must also acknowledge the excellent work the NPA has succeeded in, Christine and Suan and Lolly. I mean, the Fidentia case and cases. So I've no doubt the majority of people in the DSO and the NPA as a whole wanted to serve the country. And I welcome personally, and I think the committee, majority of the committee, do an audit as we go into the future of the DSO. Because I really do believe that there must be people in Shoei, even if they're a minority, who are not acting in the best interest of the country. It's clear to me. I don't have to be a rocket scientist to see that. One doesn't have to. This is not a commission of inquiry. It's not. Therefore, Parliament has to choose its whip carefully, Christine Lolly, Suan. We're not a commission of inquiry. We don't have the capacity to investigate. But as a committee goes, within the constraint that we operate, it's clear to the majority of us that, there are things in the DSO that are just not right. And no doubt, as we process the bills that are going to come before this committee in March, we will attend to that. The one final thing that emerges from what you say, I'm not sure why advocates are so special. Why? What is the problem with advocates having their, given the sensitive role they play in structures like the DSO, having their, financial records checked? Can you explain that to me? I'm not a lawyer, by the way. Maybe that explains it. But I don't know why advocates are some sort of special category. If you're looking at analysts, and you're looking at investigators' records, and you want to be clean, why advocates are special. And finally, you know, there are many major challenges around the extent to which the DSO in particular acts outside its mandate. And, from what we can glean from what little we know of the Comptroller Commission, there's also been an inquiry by the Intelligence Committee and so on, which they'll be reporting to in Parliament. I hope they report in the most, in the fullest way possible, so that those of us, the Safety and Security Committee, our committee, and whoever else, when we proceed with the legislation at the end of March, early April, will be as thoroughly informed as possible. But I don't know what the sensitivities are. They are going to find some way, in some form or another, of publishing that report in the APC and bringing it to Parliament. The sensitivities can be excluded, but the report should be brought to Parliament. We are a transparent, open democracy. The parts that are very sensitive can be excluded, but the rest of the report, I would suggest, and we can perhaps agree on, we will confer with the Intelligence Committee, should be brought to Parliament in some form or another before the end of March. I don't know, Llewellyn, whether it's being thought about, but we as a committee would hope that that is the way it's going to pan out. But it's also, the issue that Mama Slawe raised last week, I'm pleased to see what you're saying, Advocate McCann. You see, you can't say because you're a prosecuting authority and you're autonomous and you're provided for in the Constitution, it's not your job to restore your credibility through the media. It is. The DSO has in some respects been remarkably good, and also in other respects very bad. You're the least credible when you say that's not your role. Maybe other sectors of the NPA might have a case. But there too I want to say that I think this committee should say that we think you must do more as the NPA as a whole, given the very specific and unique political and other circumstances we're in now, to actually communicate what you do and what precisely your mandate is. And Advocate McCarthy, it is clear to me, guided by my instinct and the information I have, that you are, in some respects, acting outside your mandate. And this committee's responsibility, it is, we are the Justice Committee, to hold you to account, like we need the Gender Commission and the Human Rights Commission, to act within its mandate. That is our job. But I made a long State of Nation address type speech, but I'm providing a framework for the other questions that are going to come. But also, Advocate Mshir and Leonard McCarthy, you can reply. We will send you the text of our report, as I said last week. You can intervene and engage with that report. But finally, our views will be our own views, and we'll adopt it in this committee. Okay. In respect of the general points I'm making, do members, let me ask the ANC, because I'm speaking of the majority, and the opposition parties can speak for themselves. Do members of the ANC want to comment? And we've got Llewellyn's hand up and then Carol. And then Mama Slawe. Okay, Llewellyn?
Chair, thank you. Just to alert you and Advocate McCarthy, the rest of the NPA, and other members of the committee, Joint Planning Committee on Intelligence just this morning released its special report. It did release it. It's been tabled in Parliament, it's been released to the media via a press conference that was held from 9 o'clock this morning. which is why I was late. I would urge all members and the party on the opposite side of the floor to obtain copies. Read it for yourself.
Yeah. Okay, good. That's problem solved. Then the committee should just welcome, then in that case, Lolly, the committee just welcome the release of the report.
Okay, on that very same note, just, I think members who are on intelligence know sort of obviously what the issues are, but just for those of us in the committee as a whole, this whole recent debate about the DSO and intelligence gathering or not, just explain that to us, because I don't think the public understands that debate either. What is it that you do in terms of your legislation, and why is intelligence gathering or not an issue? Thanks.
Thank you, Chair. When looking at this report, Chair, looking at the cases and operations and the comparative performance analysis of the DSO, I want to say that, indeed, there are pockets of excellence. But then I want to say also, as you have said, that although there is so much work, good work, that has been done, but it's not known. It's only known by the NPA, us, the Department of Justice, and a few other people, as I said last time, who read the papers. Many, many people are excluded from the benefit of knowing exactly what has been happening. And I want to say, I'm sorry if this might lead to anything that we are going to say now. Perhaps, if there has been some means of making the works of the NPA generally known, there might not have been some of the issues that are cropping up now. I still want to say, yes, of course, we know that some cases are sometimes self-judicated, and they cannot be, you know, made known to the people. But I think it's very important that the work that is being done by any of the units here should be made known in one way or another, as we had discussed last time. I thank you.
Very quickly, Parliament can also play a role. Let's just apply our mind in respect of how we can. You see, we will raise our report that, you see, we want to set the hard-working, politically unbiased people that constitute the DSO, which I'm sure is the majority, are people the minister needs to reach out to. And she has already said last week in the public domain that she will be meeting with the Scorpion. I think as soon as the shape of the legislation by the end of March is clear, and she will be meeting with you, and we will endorse that in our report. And if Parliament can play any role without intruding on the autonomy, we will also play a role. We will also seek to advertise, let's just think about it, the good that the NPA does. You see, again, Advocate McCarthy, it's very instructive, like the leaks that occur don't occur about your powerful cases against the corporate sector, the good work you do. They always seem to occur around the political cases you do. Well, don't just be a rocket scientist. You know, I can be chairing this committee for 24 hours, I could have said the same thing. You know, it's just not compelling to argue that the leaks are taking place outside. Some of them are. You see, William explained to us last week that you go and see witnesses, and then these people leak, or, you know, and so on. You see scores and scores of people, so you never speak. It's an answer, but not a complete one. Look, I've said enough. Do you want to say anything to Dr. Delford and Steve around this issue to what I've said? Because you might want to disagree, if that's what you want to say.
Yes, thank you, Chair. I'm not a rocket scientist, I'm a lawyer. So, there's no way that I can support a finding of this committee that there are leaks, either deliberate or by negligence, coming from the Scorpions. I don't have any evidence to that effect. So you will have to accept my minority view.
Yes, I will accept another commission inquiry, but this, the way I'll draft it, and I'll show it to you and you can disagree, that this committee, the majority in this committee, does not find the response of the NPA compelling around issues of leaks, and we think more should be done. We're not saying that a commission inquiry has come to that conclusion. I thought I made that clear, but even then you are free to disagree.
Of course, thank you. Then I also feel a bit uneasy about, I don't know whether that's criticism, that they're not doing enough to bolster their own image in public. But that we can say for practically all state departments, for that matter. Some of them boost their image by simply delivering bad service. Like the master's offices to keep with in the family of the lawyers. I mean, what's going on there? It's chaos. It's a pathetic example of service. So I really, you must excuse me, sir, Mr. Chair, and I say this in public. It seems to me that we started here today to build the case against the Scorpions. And I will not be part of that. I will give an objective evaluation, and I will stand by that. So I don't think I'm going to say more than what I've said now.
Yeah, you find that quite offensive, actually. You see, you can't say Parliament should exercise its role vigorously. You can't say we must be more effective in making people accountable, especially organizations that are provided for in the national fiscus, and then say that we are opening the door. We are acting perfectly within what a parliamentary committee would do. We raise similar questions about the gender commission. We ask them why their report is so weak. What are they doing? Why? In the 7 months or so we interacted, I have often disagreed with you, but I found you got a case in what you say from the point of view of being reasonably objective. On this matter, just ask yourself, how different are we being today from how we've been on the Gender Commission? Or the Office of the Public Protector? Or, you see, the words that will be couched finally will be, you know, shaped by me. I'll get a draft from this. And let's look at what we think. We are utterly clear. I made it very clear at the beginning last week. I even told the press, if you want to come here, I don't know whether it's their right to be here, but I mean, I did indicate to them last week, we are not discussing the issue of the incorporation of the SACS into the Scorpions or whatever happens. Scorpions into the SACP. Oh, that's wonderful. I have no mandate from the Central Committee, therefore you'll be pleased to know to say that. But are you a big fan? I think it would be wrong for us to be less rigorous, frankly. Obviously, there are things that will spill over into the bills that are going to come to the end of the March, but that's not the case. What's being done here. We're just being as rigorous as we normally are. It would be wrong for us not to be in this case when we've been in other cases. Over to Steve Swart. I'm sure you disagree with me. I'll acknowledge your disagreement. Okay.
Chair, thank you. So we similarly can't associate ourselves with the view on the leaks and also the issue of acting outside of a mandate. And I think you also made the comment about some who do not work in the interest of the country. Now, clearly we would need to engage on that and find evidence for those statements. We would like to see the Comparepeg Commission. I think we're going to engage that. And the intelligence report. And then there might well be substance to what you say. But clearly at this stage, we do not associate ourselves with that. Thank you, Chair.
Again, I want to repeat, we're not saying that there is evidence. We're going to say that it seems to the majority in this committee. The rest will be couched carefully, but you're still free to disagree. Can we be clear? Once again, may I repeat loudly? We are not a commission of inquiry. We do not have the capacity to test, like a commission of inquiry would, evidence in the sense that the two members of the opposition are suggesting. In fact, if anybody may have that capacity, it may well be the Intelligence Committee to develop. I don't know. But it is reasonable for this committee to say that to us it seems that the NPA should do more to address its credibility issues. To us it seems reasonable that the NPA has brought part of these problems upon itself, and the DSO in particular. To us it is striking that the leaks that occur, and maybe we can do some research in that regard, seem to be preponderantly in the case of political figures, and less in the case of Fidentia and LegerNet and so on. We are offering as a committee, to the extent we can, without intruding on your autonomy, to play whatever role we might be able to actually communicate to the public, in cooperation with the Department of Justice and yourselves, the good work that many of you do. It seems to us that there is no doubt, it seems to us that there are people within the Scorpions that may well be playing a role that is not consistent with their mandate. And finally, these are issues that will be addressed in due course. That is essentially what we are going to say in the report, Christine Lund. Okay. And then the opposition parties are free. In fact, we'll acknowledge it, that the DA and the ACTP do not agree with this position. But as far as majority party go, is there any disagreement with what I'm saying? And you're free to disagree because we have no specific study group mandate. We'll discuss it further this afternoon. But is that a general sense of what we will say in our report? Good? Okay. So move on. Will you reply?
Thank you, Chairperson. I like regular debate, but I'd like to say that I think they should be based on a sound assessment of the factual position. I would want to have this closed session with the committee because I don't want to be accused of being opportunistic. I'm sitting here with a file in front of me that shows that this man's telephone has been tapped. Something that I heard about, I've read the transcript. A secret report that we sent to the President has been lifted from our computers either through unauthorized access or through computer hacking, because the real version, the signed version that went to his office is not the one that found its way into the public domain. An attorney who works with us has sent an email that was spammed from Willie Hoffman's computer, sent to his computer to imply that we have leaked it. So I'd like to stop there because I think these things don't belong in the public domain. But I'm saying to the chairperson that, I don't want to sound like a conspiracy theorist, but there's another hand here that I can't read. But let me acknowledge what you have said, chairperson. I accept everything you said. The DSO is not a perfect organization. If it was a perfect organization, we wouldn't be having these kinds of engagements. It's a microcosm of South Africa. There are rotten apples in the DSO. This man has charged two people, taken a disciplinary action against them, misconduct action against them, for exactly what you have said. Firstly, speaking out of turn, and secondly, playing a role that is not consistent with what the lady was supposed to have done. I've also, in relation to the City Press matter, we suspect that the legal opinion that was given to us by counsel has somehow been accessed in an unauthorized fashion. And that's why I spoke to Ms. Mvelazi, the head of the Integrity Unit, and asked her to do an internal investigation into that. There is another matter that I don't want to speak about that falls under the auspices of the Intelligence Committee, where we've authorized an investigation into the leaks. But I would like to have that discussion with the committee. The second thing is, I think it would be good, Chairperson, if you ask the research unit to look at the communication side of the NPA. And in that way, one could distinguish between upfront positive communication, communication found in court documents, communication about things said by other people, where they actually say who the author is, and those hopefully very rare instances where we can say these are unauthorized disclosures, these are leaks, and let's see how we can address. I mean, the one example I'd like to give, if I may,
is a decision we took around the prosecution in late December, early November. Mr. Chair was on leave, and the media was abuzz about this matter. And I've been asked by, you remember communication people, Chairperson, they went to study communication. And sometimes they think that it's important to communicate. So I said, we say nothing. And for 5 days I stuck to that line until it became impossible to say nothing. And in order to set the record straight, we issued a statement that I authorized. I cleared it with the minister just to put things in perspective. Now, I don't know, some people might regard that as a leak. Was it? As regards the Kapepe Commission of Inquiry, I think the issue about the handling of the report is a presidential prerogative. I have seen the report. It's also interesting, by the way, Chairperson. I don't know whether you've noted, in the last 2 weeks, there are all sorts of plugs in the media about the report. Now, the only people in the NPA who's got that report is me and the NDPP. No one else. I know that some people sitting behind me hold it against us. They say, don't you trust that? We were told that that report is for a particular purpose, limited for access by the national director and the head of the DSO. This man here is my investigating director. He hasn't seen it. I know, however, that there are 50 other people who've got that report, and one has to ask, well, how do people get access to bits and pieces of the report? My evidence in front of the commission is open evidence. I've given it on national television. I've got the written script here, and I'll give a copy to the chairperson's assistant. I can't take it beyond that. I just want to, Chairperson, I'm sorry you don't have the slide in front of you, but we anticipated that you might ask this question. So I've put up a slide there to say, what have we done to improve things? Because they are not perfect. Firstly, we have had a national conference last year on the 19th of April, you'll see there on the slide, where we called about 350 members of the DSO under one umbrella together, and we spend a lot of time conscientizing them, working on professional integrity, explaining the provisions of Section 416, and the fact that if people speak out of turn, they are destroying this organization. As you say, it runs contrary to the provisions of the law, it's contrary to what the Constitution requires from them, and it's just rather unprofessional and silly. Second thing we did is we started a concerted update on security clearances with NIA. I think there are about 158 that are still with NIA. You must understand that some of these security clearances come and go. People are security cleared for 5 years and it has to be renewed. You appoint new people. But the investigators, we haven't appointed a single investigator in the last 3 years that haven't been security cleared. Mr. Mgwengwe, thirdly, Chairperson, has done a national case and organizational audit spanning over 6 months, and if the committee would wish, I can avail the executive summary findings to the committee in the future debates. We've also reviewed our procedures on information gathering and issued a manual on the gathering of crime information. And finally, as I said, we as regards incident management investigations, if things come to our attention showing that our staff might have erred or might have committed irregularities, we investigate them to the fullest and we charge them. We presently have about 13 disciplinary inquiries underway in the DSO. Two relate to the sort of topic that we're discussing at the moment. So I'd like to just deal with some of the other questions before I give Mr. Mgwengwe a time to respond to the question about the mandate. I hear you on the communication front, but you must forgive me, Chairperson. I have probably been intimidated in the last year, so much so that I only speak when it's necessary. And maybe it's wrong. But I find that you say something simple and it gets misconstrued. So in this house I have to report the access I must. I actually said to Mr. Chair, is everything, it's okay to say everything openly, because I don't think everything relating to the DSO should be in the public domain with respect. And then secondly, if there's a court application and I have to file an affidavit, I respond to that. That's fine. I do believe personally, Chairperson, that the best way to bolster your image is through the quality of the work that you do. And I think the DSO can place much more emphasis by getting to the right pressure points, producing the right results at the right time in the right matters. I've noted the committee's concern about the apparent distinction between cases with a political profile and the other big corporate collapses. Why are advocates so sensitive, Jefferson? It's good that you're not one. I don't understand. Their attitude is just that they have a profession. They are advocates. They are on brief. They have their own regulation at the bar. Part of the brief is that you must trust the attorney or the advocate to whom you entrust the brief. Really, they don't want to be drawn in all the security concerns in this country. They don't believe that they are a national security threat. They're just doing their work. I must say that there are some who have been more forthcoming, who said that they prepared to engage with us about this. And I think it's something that the committee could consider when it addresses the intended restructuring. I think at this stage, I'd just like to give Mr. Nguyen with some time just to talk about how his office works when it comes to authorizing investigations.
Thank you, sir and Chair. Chair, we have a process that is followed where we authorize our investigations. In fact, I think it would be appropriate that by informing the committee members that we have decided to adopt the project management principles because the cases that we deal with are complex. We are not in a project to find that there is a lot of criminality that is involved. For an example, if somebody is going to be charged with money laundering, there has to be a predicate offense that you can find that would precede that particular money laundering charge. So, in terms of the NPA Act, there are two processes that are there that we follow to authorize our investigation. There is what we call a Section 2813 authorization. That is when we don't have sufficient information to say that a certain kind of criminality has occurred, but we suspect that there is something going on. So, in order for me to satisfy myself, as the investigative director, that there are reasonable, there is sufficient evidence or sufficient information to authorize the investigation, then you authorize that kind of, you call it a preliminary investigation. Then there is what you call it a Section 28.1 authorization. Section 28.1 authorization is the one where mostly one would resort to kind of invasive investigative techniques like your search and maybe checking your bank account, but we apply our minds, as the head of the DSO has correctly pointed out, judiciously, to check whether there are sufficient grounds to found the basis of a reasonable suspicion that somebody has committed an offense. But other than that, you would not go and employ invasive techniques unless you satisfy yourself that there is a reasonable suspicion that somebody may have been involved in committing an offense. So that process insulates our investigation so that we do not try to find that maybe in our settings people challenge us. In fact, over and above authorizing in terms of 2813 or 2831, if you want to search, you have to approach the court and apply to the court to authorize you to go out and do the search. This is another firewall, if you may, that we have in our processes. So I cannot just decide to go and search Mr. McKay's house without the court having authorized me that based on the information that we place before the court, we are justified in our action. So, and the other problem that I would like to bring to the attention of the committee as well is that the kind of cases that you deal with and the profiles of people that you deal with, they want to use sometimes even the league as a defensive mechanism, because as Mr. Bosmeyer said last week, we get information from people, and even within our own organization, our own organization is formed by South African citizens who may have their own leanings, and I quite agree that we are not doing more, but I think that has to be understood in the context of the DSO being formed by members who are South African citizens. So whatever is happening out there does affect the DSO as an organization, because we don't live in an island. But I think and I believe that even the processes that we follow before we authorize the investigation, we do enough in order to satisfy ourselves that whatever process that we follow is quite secured. When it comes to the intelligence gathering, because there is a question, in terms of Section 7 of the NPA Act, we do have one of our mandates is to gather, keep and analyze information. So we are empowered by the statute to do that. Thanks.
Can I, Llewellyn, you want to say something?
Yeah, Chair, it's the very last statement that I have a serious problem with. I think Advocate Ngwengwe is misreading that particular clause in the NPA Act. Because the Constitution very clearly says only the President can determine which structure is able to gather intelligence. Only the President. And to my knowledge, and I've been here as long as you have, Chairperson, he has not done so with regard to the DSO. Whenever we challenged Advocate McCarthy and Advocate Mshe's predecessor about the intelligence gathering capabilities, their always response was, their response was always, we're not gathering intelligence, we are gathering evidence. It's evidence related. Until of late, when Advocate McCarthy relented and agreed that they were in fact gathering intelligence. So I think that last statement by Advocate Ngwengwe needs to be properly contextualized. It's wrong.
Yeah. Did some of the religious fall within your other committee, intelligence committee? I must say I wasn't compelled by your last statement either. Because I've been doing a lot of reading, obviously. Firstly, Advocate McCarthy, you know, I don't mean to be facetious, but, hey, you know, I was not reading the books I should be reading at the age of 12 and 13. I was more interested in spy stories. And I watched almost all the movies that you would see at that age. And what you say doesn't surprise me a bit. I'm a political activist for a very long time, and I have no doubt. I mean, it's not peculiar to South Africa, the Scorpions, the NPA, and the political politicians. It's the stuff of scores and scores of movies. What is going on? You know, David Kelly died in Britain, and there's the war on Iraq, and they're leaking, and all is taking place within, you know. That's why I think if I speak to Tertius Delport outside this meeting, I don't think he's going to disagree with many things I say, actually. I think actually interesting the gap between what you're saying and what I'm saying is much narrower than the gap between us as politicians here. But let me put something to you. You know, what you say is very credible. Whether it's true or not, I don't know. That's their committee, Rowan's committee to sort out. It's very credible. I have no doubt that some of these leaks, I'm thinking to myself, not for the committee, some for the report, but since we've gone so far. On the issue of intelligence, I've been doing some work, Advocate Mshe. At the moment, I'm doing a bit more work, but at this stage, there are a whole lot of accusations. And because they're accusations, I'm saying they're merely accusations. No doubt the Intelligence Committee and whichever other authorities deal with this will pursue that further and may well be in their report. There are accusations that clause is being used to go far beyond your mandate. That's what I referred to earlier. There are accusations that it is political intelligence. It's even in the public domain. Kosash has accused you of being, to some or other degree, responsible for the Mueller report. No doubt you've replied, and there's a report out now. All I'm simply saying is that clause will hopefully be dealt with as well in the processing of the legislation, so there's no misunderstanding about what is meant by that clause. So I don't think we need to pursue it rigorously here, because it falls under that committee, and then safety and security ourselves or some adult committee will process the legislation that's coming in, and it will settle there. But in fairness to you, if you want to reply, you can reply to the minister.
Yeah, no, I think you're right. Sometimes it's semantic. Sometimes it's substance. I don't want to burden this committee. You have other groups coming up, but I appeared with the JSCI, and I said that my view has always been that it's information gathering authorized, as my colleague said. And I know that his view is everything that's done as a formal investigation is authorized by a court, but by himself has been tested in the court, and no court has ever said to us, you're acting outside your mandate. But while testifying in front of the Comparative Commission, the judge said to me, Mr. McCarthy, what you people are doing is intelligence gathering. You might not call it so. And it's for that reason that she, one of her proposals was that intelligence oversight be brought over the DSO. And I'm saying I think it's something that could be dealt with in the future debates of the committee. I don't think we should go beyond that.
Shall we move on? Imam Eddie Taylor. That's what we've been doing for the last hour and a half, Imam. We haven't noticed. This is what you mean if you want to ask a different question outside of. Okay, fine, we'll wait for that. On this specific issue, shall we close this line? Anything else? We will type our report in a way that's much more, sensible than I think both of you are making out, particularly you, Tertius, but let's look at it. Alright, now, separate set of questions, yes. But before we do, can I suggest, the slides that are not here, the version I've got, doesn't have all the slides. You presented in the public domain, so can we have the full set of slides? Then there are some outstanding issues that must be dealt with. You said, can you put a paragraph in? There are two things you ask the committee to do. Now that you are better equipped in two paragraphs, you know, you can get on the SEC rules in the US, you say this portfolio committee needs to attend to this, right? And then you said something on Section 23 and 24 of the Prevention of Crime, Organized Crime Act should be used more, it's brilliant and so on. You said, you really think that this committee needs to apply itself, whether it's in that connection or some other connection. In short, don't answer, just give us two paragraphs, about 10 lines each, and we'll slide it into the report. Okay, good, thank you. Okay, then the last thing that flows from what you're saying is that, let's round this section, this part out by saying, can we repeat, we really think the majority of you in the DSO are doing good work, and this committee commits itself doing what we can to raise with the executive to boost the morale of the TSO. And I don't think the end of the world is nigh. Anyway, I'm an atheist, so for me to say that, I suppose, is not surprising. But I'm sure Imam is also going to say the same thing. You know, let's make a positive use of this time. Let's see this. You know, I've said this last week, Advocate, I'm sure. You know, the ESCOM crisis needn't have happened. But since it's happened, let's use it as an opportunity to get us all to conserve energy. Maybe it's a good thing it happened because it was a looming crisis. In a similar vein, maybe the challenges you've got will help us to grow and develop and triumph over what we are currently locked in. I like your attitude, Advocate McCarthy. It's a positive one. That notwithstanding the challenges, we can triumph over it. And I think we can, and we all need to work together to do so. Imam? Did you meet in the ACC today? There was no conspiracy. I genuinely didn't know that, you know, that was happening. And he has enrolled in here just to, we're not acting on a scene, okay? So don't investigate that. Save your money. That report is in the ACC today.
I don't know. I, on my way in this morning, I got an SMS saying that the JSCI is holding a press conference this morning in G26. Please be there. You'll receive your copy of the report there. So it'll be published Whether it's in the ATC, I can't really.
And he laughed. He said he's going to some press conference. That's right. That must have been the same one. Okay. Steve, so we'll get a copy. Imam?
Chairperson, I had no doubt in my mind that there is a need for a specialized unit at this stage, you know, in our transition in South Africa, whether in conjunction with the police or outside. But there is a need for a specialized unit. Yeah. The question which I want to ask is, you know, my own admission, Mr. McCarthy, you said that the Scorpions or the DSO, they choose the cases. And they choose the cases. And the perception out there is, you know, that crime and criminality in South Africa, right, is, you know, dependent entirely upon the TSO. It's a saving grace for crime in South Africa, right? But then, obviously, the machinery which we have for fighting crime in South Africa is bigger than the DSO itself. It's the police, it's intelligence, they are the structures also, right? The perception out there is, you see, and maybe the media say that they're rolling this, or maybe the Scorpions also said, yeah, or the DSO itself, right? That they push this view, you see, that the DSO is the be-all and end-all to fight crime in South Africa. So no matter what our operating was in South Africa. Can you comment on that one? Then you've been talking about a dedicated course, you know, this idea, right? That we have specialized courts in South Africa, right? Obviously, we need to look at it again, but we have specialized courts. And then we have also, you know, judiciary specializing in labor and in various other fields, right? It might not be that you have a specialized group, but you might have specialized people, you know, just doing this type of work, which is called particularly organized crime and syndicate crime, which might, you know, enhance the effectiveness of, you know, the specialized units here, right? Maybe the committee should consider that, the chairperson, the president, and then talk, you know, about it. The other thing is that, what is the other point now? Yeah, let me think about it.
We're going to conclude this. Carol, you have your hand up.
Yeah, just a very basic question. Whether in the opinion of the DSO, looking at stats over the past few years, whether they can see a decrease in organized crime, that being the first question. And the second question, when Advocate McCarthy said that the prosecuting skills and levels were not up to world standards, what are we doing to address that?
I just want to ask you a quick question about, you know, your focus on the top 100 criminals. How many arrests and successful prosecutions have been conducted? This is raised by our researchers. There are lots of other questions here that I'm going to share what we do with. We can't, you know, go through all of them. We give you a copy of this, and we give you 14 days to reply to. So there's 7 questions here that Sue Ann has raised that you can reply to. We can really insert it into our report. Some of them will haul out very positive questions. We can see the questions. They are leading in the opposite direction from what Church of Telford suggested here. Go ahead. You advertised 280, we told you, during the two. This was in your report, right? How many have been filled? I know it's a difficult time. Silly question you might ask. Don't you guys live in the real world, you might say. Nevertheless, for what it's worth, if the question's silly, it reflects more on our researchers than on me. Yes. Yeah.
Well,
The other message came to my mind. It's very short. Because of plea bargaining, it does become part of the law. Can we get from the DSO how many cases that were resolved with plea bargaining and how many is with the full,
support? I'm going to have a guideline to that. So, okay. There we are. That's it for now. Thank you. Thank you. That's your question. For always. I will give the committee written feedback about the matters you've raised. I'll also reply looking at things more empirically about the actual number of cases, but I'm pitching it at 25% over the last 3 years of our cases that have been disposed through plea bargaining. Chairperson, as regards the filling of vacancies, I said at the close of the financial year we were on 509 people. We are now with the appointment that Mr. Mshe and I signed yesterday on 540. So it's interesting that despite everything happening, there's been a growth. You know, human beings are most amazing. But I'll do a more accurate breakdown for the chairperson, also in terms of categories. As far as the skills are concerned, I wouldn't mind actually availing our training plan to the committee. Like all good government departments, nicely made up. I'm just editing it a little because my dad was a school teacher and taught me how to use a red pen. And then I'll avail it to the committee. But, you know, when you wake me at 4 in the morning, ma'am, and ask me what are the key concerns for us, it's probably three things. First is the financial markets and the working of the financial systems. Minister Manuel asked me at the DSO, at the NPA stakeholder conference last year, Leonard, why is it that in this country, after the ETOs of this world and the scorpions, 10 years later, we are unable to predict what goes wrong from entry point to exit point in the financial system? He was, of course, referring to the Fidentia case. So that is area number one. The second thing is litigation skills to deal with highly complex cases. That is absolutely something that the country, I'm not even talking about the scorpions, forget about the scorpions, as a country we should invest serious energy, money and resources into that. I was an advocate many years ago, and I remember that some advocates, when they walk into your office, you feel intimidated. First time I appeared here in front of judges in the Cape, I realized that there are much cleverer people than me. So it is really a difficult thing, and I think if this committee can help us with that, Chairperson, as a country, as a prosecuting authority, forget about the DSO. The third issue is the understanding of technology and technology crimes. It is, the Scorpions have a small unit called, what do you call it there, Mr. Wengman? The DDU, we love acronyms, the Digital Detectives Unit. I can avail that plan to the committee what they do, but we are not dealing with one-tenth of what we should be doing. It is something that if it's not regulated and we don't meet the compass, we're going to suffer as a country. Chair, then just the last four questions. I'll end up with the first one last. Whether there's been a decrease in organized crime, I'd rather want to sit in that close committee and engage with a committee about this, because it's easy to say, no, of course it just shot up. I hear institutions throwing around, there are 3,000 syndicates of this and 300,000 gangsters, and I don't believe that is helpful. We do an analysis every year, Chairperson. We call it a threat analysis. And we look at organized crime, and we've identified seven key commodities. It's human beings, drugs, money, motor vehicles, guns, oil, and corruption. When I talk about oil, I actually mean minerals. And then you look at the role players, you look at the affected industries, you look at the interlinkages. I don't think it is appropriate for me to say it's shot up or it's gone down. I think we've done as a country, as a law enforcement authority, we've had some serious inroads into key areas. If I speak to people internationally, they come and say to us, tell us how you did that. Or you've helped us very much in this area. Or you've done cases which in other countries wouldn't have been dealt with. So I'd rather want to sit in that closed session with the committee and come up. This is a great question to ask. You're not asking for, you see, we're testing your performance, right, in a very limited, qualified sense, where you're not going to reveal sensitive details. would it be reasonable to say that yes, organized crime has been reduced, but the extent and nature of this is something that you want to discuss further? Wouldn't it be reasonable?
Yeah. I would go along with that. The manifestations are worrying, because it's like an embryo assuming different dimensions. And then just on the dedicated court, what the GSO is saying is that we have at the moment 445 projects. 160 of those cases are parted in court. The view was that it wouldn't be sustainable to have a specialized court for the GSO. I think what we're asking for is dedicated court time, but that's something that must be managed properly. I spoke about the skills. I'll deal with the researchers' questions. On your question about the top 100, the last time I reported, I said we've dealt with 39 of the 100, and I think I said in this committee that I think the police have done much better than us. Chairperson, on the last question about the GSO being the be-all and end-all of, I think it's a very dangerous perception with respect. The South African police are the frontispiece of law enforcement in this country, and we must support them. Firstly, accept them and support them, because they are the lead agency, and so is the prosecuting authority working in conjunction with them. The GSO was an adjunct to come in at a niche level to deal with organized crime. I think it's a very dangerous perception. In fact, it's completely untrue, by the way, because there are many GSO members sitting here, and if they had hammers, they would hit me on the head when I say this. I said this publicly before. We are probably 60% as effective as we should be. In addition to that, I think 30% of our performance is inflated, just because of public perception. But Imam, yes, when I talk about choosing cases, what I'm really saying is we choose cases in line with our intake criteria in four areas: organized crime, high-level corruption, complex financial crime, and offenses under the Prevention of Organized Crime Act. And everything is mandated by the investigating director and authorized properly. What I was saying is we have a little bit of flexibility. We could therefore say this case does not fall within our mandate. This case is too low down the food the chain, and so we only deal with the high level, top end kind of cases. So I think that's about it.
Shall we move on to the next area? Imam, you're looking unhappy. Okay, yeah, sure.
On the top end of crime, we've been talking about McCarthy, you know. If something happens, you know, in the area of crime, I don't run to Scorpions or the Puppies or to you, they go to the police. Right? Where do these come from? Where is initiated? Scorpions or DSO or police? That's a high level area of crime.
Chairperson, I think when we meet with the committee, we will give to the committee circular one which sets out the intake criteria, and we can have that discussion. But it's really looking at, like the financial case came to us, there was no debate about it. Because what you have in the GSO, you've got forensic auditors, you've got analysts, you've got accountants, you've got prosecutors and investigators under one umbrella who can be project assigned to a big case like that. They have the time, the resources and the energy to do it. And the skills, I would hope. So those are the sort of cases that we'd be dealing with. But it's difficult to draw a line and say, this one goes to the police, this one comes to the DSO. It depends on often who refers it. Thank you, Shepard.
Move on to the next. Is that the National Prosecuting Service? Is that correct?
Thank you. What other units besides NPS have to answer their show? Yeah, and then we're going to come back to general questions, right? As you can see, one of the things raised by our researchers, and it struck me as correct, which you should apply at the end. You see, normally we have institutes that would do like a 3-year strategic plan. And then for each year their business plan, where they set key performance targets and so on. It's not clear to us, you have a 2020 strategy. You seem to operate slightly differently. So at the end, we want some clarity about how we monitor the NPA as a whole in the absence of what we call a 3-year strategic plan.
and so on. But, you know, we'll have to give you at least 15 minutes. Managing time, I'm going to ask Lolly to help me. But we'd like to finish by 12:30, latest quarter to one. But what I'm saying is that I'm just alerting you that one of the things we have to do in our report to find out why you don't have that sort of thing or where we find it. But you're leaving, are you? Yeah, thank you very much for your time. You'll talk to them.
Thank you very much, Professor. This, as was pointed out, is the presentation now by the National Prosecution's Service. The slide on the wall now essentially just outlines the mission statement of the NPA as it appears in our strategic plan. A few highlights before we go to the technical aspects of the report, Chairperson. We've highlighted very few cases, but I think one that we think maybe was significant in the period under review is the case of Fernwell Basia. That is a case in which, as a result of the involvement of one of our TPP officers, the case was successfully argued in the Constitutional Court, and that ended up extending the definition of rape, rather extending the common law to expand the definition of rape to include the sexual penetration of males. I am not going to bore the committee with all these cases because of the constraints of time. I'm just going now to move to the case overview slide. Essentially, what this slide endeavors to indicate is the workload of the court as well as the output. And then later in the report, these indicators are going to be unbundled further and be substantiated by figures to indicate either the drop or the increase in the various indicators. Now, if you look at the output in the High Court, the slide indicates that the inflow of cases actually is more than the outflow of cases. But if you look at the cases finalized as well as the finalized minimum sentences, that constitutes almost a quarter of the pie chart, which we will submit a Chairperson that is a commendable output. The following slide will indicate the output or the workload in the regional court. You will observe that in the regional court, more cases have been removed from the roll than the cases that were finalized. But we need to point out here that the number of cases that were removed from the roll include withdrawals, include cases struck off the roll, include cases where warrants were issued, and also cases that were transferred to other courts. Further down in the presentation, we will also seek to advance the status of our withdrawal rate. This slide indicates the output in the district court. You will notice in the district court also that the incoming cases far outweigh the finalization rate, most importantly. And I think the finalization rate will dwell more on them later in the report, because we are going to acknowledge that there has been a decline in the cases finalized in our statistics for the period under review. On a yearly basis, Chairperson, we try to conduct two audits. First, an audit of the withdrawal cases, as well as an audit of the outstanding rolls. What you see now on the slide is the result of our withdrawal audit. You'll observe that during the the year under review, there has been a reduction in cases that were withdrawn. And then the bar graph indicates the reasons for the withdrawal. A substantial amount of cases are withdrawn at the request of the complainant. Then the following bar is prima facie, when there is no prima facie case, and so on. The purpose of this audit, the withdrawal audit, amongst other things, is to determine whether maybe there cannot be interventions that may try to reduce the cost of the withdrawal. For instance, if one were to ask, why do complainants, after having made the charge, go now and seek to withdraw it? So that is the purpose of the audit. And if we are able to establish cogent reasons, certainly interventions can be devised to ensure that the bar gets smaller. The withdrawal audit also tells us the type of cases where the withdrawal cases, where the cases, rather the type of offenses where the most cases are withdrawn. You will observe in the bar graph also that common assault is the mostly withdrawn case, followed by assault with grievous bodily harm, and so on. The same rationale here, Chairperson, would be applicable. Why would people, for instance, after having been picked up, seek to withdraw cases?
That in our audit that we can add it in future. So then my opinion.
In fact, I think your input now actually illustrates the need for this audit and also to devise intervention, as you say. Then the second type of audit that I refer to, Chairperson, is the outstanding role audit. The purpose of this particular one is aimed at determining the prevalence of certain types of crimes in our court. It is also aimed at determining the cycle time of cases, how long our cases remain on the roll. And it also seeks to determine the reasons for multiple postponements, which are causing delays in the finalization of cases. And also it looks at the status of the awaiting trial detainees. This is the last audit, or rather the audit for the Bureau of Standard Review, indicated that there is a steady rise in the number of accused persons. The count. But it also indicated that there is a decrease in the number of awaiting trial detainees. Part of the prevalence of the outstanding cases audit, we also look at the prevalence of cases. This particular audit indicated to us that violent crimes are still the most prevalent, with 62% of that pie chart, and included in this is sexual violence. Another increase that can be noted from the chart is also that robbery with aggravating circumstances, and also other types of robbery are also more prevalent than in the previous year. Well, that would include cases like fraud, cases like theft, cases that is what an economic element is. Yes. And where there can be a monetary value that can be attached. Another finding from the audit indicated to us, if you look at the second bar from the bottom, the investigation, you will observe that there's been a dramatic improvement in cases that are outstanding on the road because of FOIA investigation. and we attribute that to our sort of enforcement of proper screening by cases before they are in court. This next set of slides now is going to give us what I want to call maybe the technical analysis of the indicators that we've had before. First, bar graph indicates the conviction rate. If you look at the commentary of the target, you will observe that all our courts have exceeded the target. The high court target is 85%, regional court 70%, and the district court is 85%. And the actual achievement of the target demonstrates that the target has been exceeded. In this particular regard, Chairperson, I want to refer to the work of the researcher and point out that at the specific area dealing with the NPS, reference is made to the NPS not having met the target. I don't know whether the researchers want to explain that, but I think it was an error. Yes, on their part. Yes. Thank you very much. Yes. In relation to the conviction rate, when the process, like you requested, Chairperson, I think towards the end of our presentation, someone, I think my colleague currently here will unveil the strategy 2020. One of the projects flowing out of that strategy is our community court project, and the slide on the board now indicates that these courts have achieved a 95% conviction rate. They are serving a very unique and useful table with this court, but I think Karen will explain that fully. The second indicator is the finalized cases. The actual achievement of the finalized cases measured against the target demonstrates a decrease. Significant in the regional courts and also in the district courts. One of the constraints that we've highlighted in this regard, Chairperson, and this is going to resonate with other indicators as well, is the new method of caseflow management. I am advised that in a previous presentation to this house, case flow management was reflected as a major, or rather as one of the contributing factors in some of our gift performance. I want to dwell on this case flow management a little bit, because I want to anticipate the question as to what have we done in the previous year. An engagement with the magistrate first of all, if I can explain what it means, I know the committee is aware, just for purposes of putting the context. Case law management is a system where the presiding officer is in charge of the placement of cases on the roll. In other words, the magistrate chooses that on date so and so, my diary is going to have 3 cases and no more. The prosecutor might wish to have 6 or 7, and the presiding officer is going to put the cases, and that is it. Now we want to submit that this has got an effect of negatively sometimes affecting our indicators, essentially the finalized cases as well as the court hours. Now what have we done about this thing? A level of engagement has been established with the magistrates at a national level. We meet with them every second month. They are a committee called the LCMC, the Lower Court Management Committee. For the past year, indeed, a resolution was taken that case flow management, per se, is going to be a standing item in these meetings. I do want to submit that maybe not enough was done in using that platform to ensure that were able to, amongst ourselves, determine that if a particular indicator on a month-to-month basis begins to suffer, then we need to use the venue of the LCMC meeting. I do want to propose, Shepherd, that this year we are going to be a bit more aggressive in that regard to ensure that these indicators improve. Another suggestion that has been put to us, which we are going to consider favorably, is that the court services section of the Department of Justice essentially are the people who are supposed to ensure that case law management works. So we are, in our first meeting with the LCMC this year, going to broach the idea with them that the principles outlined in the case flow management booklet are applied to the letter. This booklet, amongst other things, prescribes that there must be monthly case flow management meetings. And we have it on good authority that in some clusters, these meetings don't take place. So I am going to ensure, with the assistance of the head of the organization, that the head of court services, the DDG at Justice, I think it is Advocate Simon Gianni, assist us in this regard to ensure that we get all the clusters to conduct the case flow management meetings as they should. And I want to submit if that happens, surely the indicators like our finalization rates are going to start to show an improvement.
If I can talk quickly about divergence, Shepherdson, is one of the areas that we want to pay particular emphasis on. Our target for the year under consideration of diversion, this is the slide now on the wall, was to have a 10% increase. But in all the courts, that has been exceeded, I think, with 8.8%, because the actual achievement of the diversion was 18.8%. The figures, very briefly, are that there was an increase from 37,000 to 44,000 between the year ending 2006 and the year ending 2007 in March. We do want to, you know, this slide is also indicating that maybe there may not be uniformity in how our various clusters apply diversion. And there may be also explanations for this. Not all clusters are going to have the same capacity to achieve diversion. This is influenced by, amongst other things, the availability of resources. For diversion to work well, you need, for instance, NGO involvement and also the availability of certain facilities. But we are proud to demonstrate that the Valran cluster, one of our clusters in the TPD, the Transvaal Provincial Division, for the year under consideration, constituted 33% of all our divisions. I think out of the total, they did something in excess of 20,000, and I think that indeed is commendable. We have commended them for that. The slide on the chart now is the court hours. Here, Chairperson, there has been what one can even call significant decline in the court hours. Yeah. And the precursor that I made about poor case law management is applicable with the call for here, Chairperson. This approach of engaging the magistrates with case law certainly is of much relevance here, if not anywhere else, in terms of the court hours. One other issue over and above case flow, keeping problems, as we call them, is the whole question of the legal aid board. I am not sure whether the Department of Justice itself has addressed the committee, but we do know that the legal aid board, as a stakeholder in this value chain, is having serious problems. And for obvious reasons, if you don't have public defenders in those cases, they are going to affect the number of hours that the case is going to sit. So I do want to urge that whoever comes to this house and talks about the legal aid board, it should be mentioned that we really would pray that the legal aid board problems are resolved. In our report on the annual report of the department, we said we're going to bring you, the legal aid board, etc., all of you together to look at court hours and to look at the number of cases, be obsessed with it, and so is the committee, that are being dropped. Now, then we were told that the criminal justice system is being overhauled, and we decided, in fact, today was the day that we were going to bring the minister and deputy minister and DG here at the forum. But the executive is still saying it's work in progress and so on, but very shortly, they are going to appear before this committee, Safety and Security Committee, because we'll do it as a cluster. And so we're going to link it all up, but it'll be a whole day session. So we have that in mind. Before I forget, as long as we put this down, the Master's Court, we must put that issue on the agenda. Master's Office must put that issue on the agenda. I've been getting letters of complaint as well. We had it on last year, but then we had to finish a bill. We dropped it. Welcome, Bolalani. So we're going to do it in the next 6-8 weeks. We're going to call them here. I should let you know.
Thank you very much, Chairperson. Indeed, such a session would be very useful for us. We would welcome that. The slide on the wall now, Chairperson. The Scotland Regional Court. This is one if one can employ the phrase of pockets of excellence. There is one particular regional court magistrate there who we think employs case law management as it should. And the output of his court is just an illustrative example of how case law management, if properly employed, can result in improved performance. Then we've got the slide now that indicates our slide times or our lead times. In the high and the different costs, our cycle times, Chairperson, are on target. In the regional courts, we are having a serious problem. We want to acknowledge that. If you look at the regional court indicator, where we were saying that 75% of cases should not be more than 6 months on the road, the achievement of the target there is at 57%. One of the issues that was identified as subsequent to the year ending 2007 was that this target range of 6 months, Chairperson, is not workable. So we have increased now the achievement of that target to 9 months. In other words, what we are sitting with now is that 75% of our cases on the regional court roll should not be more than 9 months. And I want to suggest that maybe when we come to this house for a similar report next year, that adjustment of the target should have shown an improvement. There is a national backlog project that is being driven by the Department of Justice, the court services section of the Department of Justice. It is primarily focused on the regional courts, and it is already showing a significant improvement, Chairperson, on the reduction of the outstanding run. It is still far from where it should be, but secondly, the movement is downward rather than upward. And we are also pleased to be informed by DOJ that it has been actually budgeted for, I think, to the year 2010 in the E&E. Yes, and this slide now talks to the assistance that we obtain from the backlog project. The community courts that I alluded to earlier, we've got 12 in operation, and these community courts are what other people refer to as, I don't want to call them that they deal with minor cases,
but there is a phrase that they deal with quality of life offenses, you know, dealing with nuisances, people who make basically our lives a little bit irritable in the street. And that is the purpose of those courts. And indeed, they are showing an improvement. So that's this, particularly the first one, the 4.3 initiative. We have embarked on a fully-fledged project with the South African Police Services to deal with organized crime. 68 posts for specialized prosecutors on organized crime have been established. And in all the offices of the Directors of Prosecution, a dedicated senior manager at the level of Deputy Director of Prosecution has been appointed to give specific attention to organized crime. This was born, I think, by the statement by the President. I think it was in last year's State of the Nation address that organized crime really should receive attention. So we think that this initiative is going to show a dent in organized crime. The specialist test unit, I think, has been mentioned in this house before, and it is still continuing to produce excellent results with their conviction rate standing at 5%. The project cleanup is also an ad hoc project that we sometimes do on certain years, depending on the need, when we identify that the amount of time available to prosecutors during the week to deal with admin issues, essentially issues like your inquests, reading old dockets that are not getting particular attention, as well as extended consultation with witnesses. We did it for the period under review, and it really showed an impact. More 3,400 dockets were screened and prepared for court. 2.9 inquests were dealt with, and 839 outstanding files were finalized, and 34,700 dockets were dealt with. Of particular importance in this slide now, Chairperson, is the issue of awaiting trial detainees. As part of our strategy 2020, one of the projects similar to the community prosecution project was a project to create some best practice in the management of awaiting trial detainees. Guidelines were developed and were distributed, and awaiting trial prisoners have decreased, and the reduction also shows that is also shown in the audit that I've already touched on, Chairperson. If more information is needed on the guidelines, the champion of the project, Advocate Ibiye, is available. She can give more elucidation on that. The slide now on the wall is an audit of the outstanding cases. This slide, Chairperson, should be read with the earlier slide that I've shown when I was doing the overview. It is essentially just giving you the figures to the sites that I've already outlined. On the way forward, Chairperson, maybe this is just a nice way of ending. We've got a clear role to play in society, and we need to fulfill our responsibility in making the criminal justice system work. While our task is getting bigger and more demanding, but we are hopeful that we will make the impact needed. A lot of good work we want to suggest has been achieved, and has been, of course, been hampered by personnel and resources problems. Thank you very much. The questions are not going to be answered by myself only. That is why my colleagues are here.
You mean you're acting like a typical politician? Do the easy part.
And take the credit, Steve.
So just again,
The issue of the withdrawals that we mentioned again, we did mention some of the issues there. I'm just trying to understand how you relate with SAPS. They have a certain number of cases, and we mentioned it the other day. We understand about 2 million cases were reported to them and then getting to you, and high withdrawal rate. And then the issue of diversion, you indicated a percentage of 18%. What was that? If you could just clarify what that was, a success and failure, and how you are managing to do diversion without a statutory framework. What is the result being of the delay in the Child Justice Act? Has that prevented you? Yes. Thank you. And as per my usual statement, again, to commend you on very good work. As a previous prosecutor, I understand the constraints that you're under. Many years ago, Simon's Town Magistrates Court.
Yes, and may I add that I started my prosecuting career in the year of our Lord, 1963. And I was a state advocate prosecutor in the office of the Attorney General Transvaal, Pretoria, at the time of the State versus Mandela and others. So, interesting time. maybe a persecutor. Jeb, what is the position with vacancies? Are you understaffed at present? I gained from other reports that we have a large number of vacancies in the department. How is it with the prosecuting staff?
We're pending a major all-day discussion. People have to add. Can I quickly add one or two things? One is, I also want to commend you. Just one thing, though, again and again we experience this. You know, we are advocate of share. In Parliament, we are very challenged. People come, and they present such a lucid account of all the challenges, right? And yet out there, it's a press covering, I don't know, we're journalists here, put your hand up, I can choose my words carefully. Out there, things don't just match, you know? I mean, it's a thing I'm sure all of us is familiar. You know, like, you're such a lucid account. It's quite sober. Well, I mean, I think myself, others may know better. But then what happens is the quality of your insights that are brought to bear in your submission to us don't get reflected in practice, you know. I'm just struck by how clear you are about challenges. Okay, some of the quick issues. Can you tell us, you see, this committee will lapse. It will begin to peter out end of August, I think, and lapse altogether, you know, shortly after that, well, early next year, I think. Now, in the limited time we've got, we will write an exit report for the new committee. But can you tell us what one or two things we can do to improve your role? How can we help as a committee to put pressure on the department, because that's our role, to deliver? Just two things. What would you suggest, right? This phosphorus, that's how you say the word. Why is it so good? You haven't really spelled out. Is it a subjective thing that you've got a good magistrate? Is it just the quality of leadership? Is that the issue? And why can't we translate gradually, incrementally, those lessons elsewhere? Why are court hours declining? I know when I read Christine's report, I'm very struck by her obsession with it, right? But then when I look at it, it doesn't seem so big. And yet, all of you keep saying it. So obviously the actual figures there, because I remember when you did the one report up at Christian's, it was really a significant decline. But yet you all kind of say that. What can be done about that? Obviously it's not your area, but maybe you can suggest. Look, the other questions can come later. Okay, thank you. On the legal aid board, we want to tell you we are strictly aware of the issue. They're going to be here on that day. We are engaging with them over the phone. Now, I know I've got to report back to the committee on a lot of things I've been doing outside committee. It's to do with the report that I'm going to table to you tomorrow. Those five reports, and so tonight will be seven reports. We have to achieve at least one third of what we say we're going to achieve before we dissipate. If I can start with the
with the issue of the court hours. You know, I actually asked this myself, you know, particularly from our people captain the set, who engage with our chief of tutors in the classroom, as why is causing this. Our statistics have reflected that the number of court sessions is gradually on the decline. The number of literal court days where the court sits, and that is going to be coupled with case law management, is going to have an impact on the court hours. Now, so I asked the question as to what is causing the declining in the court sessions, in the court sittings. Now, some of the, unfortunately, this thing is going to go back to magistrates again, because it is the amount of allocated theoretical courts. If one magistrate goes away on a theoretical court, there is a sitting in the main seat of court that is not sitting. So I think we've identified that maybe proper case law management, we really are going to raise this issue in our engagement with them as to proper management of particular of theoretical courts should be enforced. And I think that will resolve primarily the issue of court hours, coupled, of course, with the initiative. And we're going to push this very forcefully, Jefferson, this engagement with the LCMC and the proposals that we have via the court services division of the department. The Fosloras, maybe Karen, if we want to talk about the Fosloras and the hours that are shown there.
I think to start off, it's an old prosecutor's fault, I remember, and his son is currently a prosecutor. But it's in their blood. But I think the main thing is, unfortunately, case flow management, and this is a prime example, rests on, it's very person orientated. It is a good magistrate in court who is planning properly, case flow management is working like a charm. But unfortunately, it's not happening in all the courts. And I think one of the ways in which we can ensure that magistrates do take the responsibility for their courts is to set targets for them. I think one of our biggest problems as prosecutors with all these targets and deadlines that we must make is that there's no such thing on the magistrates. They are so independent and untouchable that, you know, unless you sit in a forum like the LCMC with them, we don't have any, the lower court management meeting. But we need to set targets for them so that we can have also a leverage on them.
Department of Justice.
Yes,
Department. Why don't we just put that in the report? Can you agree on that? Okay. They're not untouchable. Nobody. Not even judges,
so
not the president. Yes, so fine. Let's just do it. Shall we? Well, the vacancies, Chairperson, I was told that our HR manager, who is here with us, wants to answer that question.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In terms of vacancies within NPS specifically, during the period 1 July 2007 to 14 December 2007, the NPA as a whole made 912 new appointments, of which 737 was in NPS. Of that 737 NPS headquarters, of those 737 was only 11 posts, which means that roughly in the region about 80% of the vacancies filled between the period July to December came from NPS and would have been in the DPP specifically. Yeah, I have the information available, so it will be provided. Thank you, sir. I think we should be much more broader on this issue of court hours, because as much as I agree that part of the problem it will be the non-competitive of case law management, but we must also must bear in mind that also defense lawyers are a problem. Sometimes the magistrate is there, the procedure is ready, the defense lawyer is caught up in another case. I think we should also look at that.
We're choosing one or two things that I think we can do, but we are aware that it's a very complex issue, you know.
Yeah, that's useful.
It may be contained in the submission or the presentation that has just been made, but for some time now, we have been asking that it involves the cooperation of the South African Police Service. I'll give you two examples. We did oversight visits to Magistrates Court in Kroonstad and Bethlehem, which is where it worked. The chief prosecutor in those courts worked with a senior police officer and scanned a docket and made sure that everything in that docket was complete and ready before the case came before a magistrate. Now, we appealed with everyone. I concede, Chair, that we need the cooperation of the Police Service here, because we're not readily going to say, okay, an inspector or a superintendent is going to leave his or her post and go and sit in a magistrate's court. Because that's what it means. It's only a police officer at that level who can pick up the phone and say to an investigating officer, there are three affidavits missing from this docket. Go and fetch them now. The prosecutor does that, and the investigating officer tells him, don't get stuffed. Quite rightly so. Doesn't have the authority to give him that instruction. So perhaps in dealing with this particular challenge, Chair, that is something we need to look at and find ways of making that particular system work. As I said, it worked in those two magistrates' courts. I think Imam visited courts in his, where he found it also worked there. And other members of the O committee can confirm that they also found magistrates' courts where this system worked very well.
In respect of the last question, the NPA has had a project in the last year, in the current year, where we have developed a model around prosecutor guided investigation to extend this to our lower courts. We've looked at various international best practices in this regard. How does the prosecutors interact with the police? And we have now come up with proposals in terms of implementation. We've just recently identified pilot sites in all our courts of the country. And the concept is that we're going to get the prosecutor and the investigator to come together at a very early stage of that investigation. A case plan will have to be developed by those two individuals. And the accountability structures will be put in place, with the senior public prosecutor on the one end and the branch commander at a particular station will have to take responsibility to ensure that whatever is agreed upon in the case plan is actually done. So if there is outstanding investigation that needs to take place, we would want to see that a timeline is inserted in the case plan, who takes responsibility to do what, and that people are held accountable in terms of those taskings that they have undertaken to do. So it is the same concept that you have explained, but what we have decided to do is really to develop this, to cast it in stone in a sense. To say to prosecutors and investigators, here is a model in terms of how you can do your work better, to improve the quality of the investigation. We have incorporated that into a training document, so that then we go out to all our prosecutors in the country, and start this project in our courts, we can actually train people how to do it. And that's the difference. Before we had these pockets of excellence, as you say, but nobody documented how we want people to do this work. And I think that at the end of this year, when we do the evaluation and the monitoring, which is part of the project, hopefully we will see some of the fruits of that model. But we believe that the PGI approach is really going to take us a long way in sorting out some of the quality issues in our courts, both on the investigation side and on the prosecution side.
Can we note that in our report and then ask for the report back next year on progress in this regard? Okay.
Can we then move on to the next unit, please?
There are a few questions, Chairperson, that were asked.
Yes,
the withdrawal rate, I think the question as to... I've heard this one before myself, that there are so many cases, that there are so many crimes reported, and cases that are reported to the police, but the output of the court is very, very low. And here we are telling the committee about a drop in the withdrawal cases. But I think our audit of withdrawal cases, of cases withdrawn, we audit what has come to us. You know? And I think that is where the distinction should be. In this move towards the review of the criminal justice system, maybe a mechanism will be found when such, for instance, can link their assets with us. Because I am unable to agree that our withdrawal statistics should be measured against the 2 million that is mentioned. But maybe if we and FAPS were, when we're combining our statistics, we're working together. And to the honorable member, I want to suggest that he's aware that this is not happening. In fact, this is what I think Parliament is striving towards. That the criminal justice system has got a unified method of dealing with the figures. So I'm unable to give you a very cogent answer, but I think this thing would improve significantly if the outcome of the review of the criminal justice system, and I cannot wait for that day, sir, when we come here as one criminal justice group. Yes. Thank you.
Yes. Tell you why you may be correct in your, well, that's your view. 68% we found when the Department of Defense mentioned similar and self-defense. Of the cases that withdrawn from the court, whether you use the baseline of 2 million or it's still too high, and I think we all agree. But we recognize the challenges you have.
What we are doing is to our drug crisis, and we were closely with the social development to our drug crisis. They are responsible for certain programs. So when we decide to divert a chunk, we refer to social development, and we keep the case on the roll until such date that we have been completed program successfully. This has proven to be successful from, I think, 37 to 44,000, an increase in 1 year's 12-month time. So, experience has shown that it is, in fact, a successful procedure and alternative methods to reduce our toll cases.
The researcher's overview report, there's lots of questions there that you will probably, not from you, in fact, actually reply. Okay, thanks. The next unit, please, Advocate Michelle.
Good morning,
I must alert you, there's a SCOPA report, Advocate Mishra, I think that was sent to you, flowing from your exchange with them. This committee is meant to follow up. I will ask Lonnie to give members a copy, and then you can reply to those issues, rather than take them up here.
Introducing myself, I'm Daryl Simelani. I'm the acting CEO, I'm also the head of resources. Next to me is Advocate Karen van Lensburg. She's acting head of strategy. You will notice all the acting appointments. Next to her is our CFO, Brian Graham. And at the back, we have our head of integrity, Ms. Tipuam Velase. She's also acting Tipuam Velase. She's also the acting head of security and risk. And next to her is Mr. Romeo Adams. Romeo is our head of HR. MMG. He was appointed on the 2nd of January. That post has probably been vacant for 2 years, I think, if not a bit more. That is my team. Thanks. I'll start off by looking at the very briefly at the organigram of the office of the CEO. The CEO's post has been vacant since June last year. We know that Marianne Spark resigned. She was the first CEO in the MTA and resigned June last year. And then we have reporting to her and or to the CEO and to myself is the CFO. And then I would have the whole resourcing team, which is your human resources, your information, research and policy, security and risk, and finance and procurement, which report to me. And then we have the other units at the bottom, which is your strategy, headed by Karen at the moment, a one-woman show. We have risk management, also a one-man show. We have integrity with Dipu and her team. Then we have communications, and we have our PMO, which is our project management office. In the office of the CEO, strategic management, our highlights, as was indicated in our report, was our stakeholder conference that we held in March. It was very good because we were able to tell people what we do, our stakeholders in particular, for a better understanding. We have the intention of holding this at least every second year so that we share ideas with our stakeholders. It was really well attended. We had high profile people attending the conference and giving us insight into their experiences. We had Maria Ramos, Trevor Manuels, and all those people giving us some insight into how we can do our business better. Our annual plans for business needs and regional plans are aligned to our strategy 2020, which I'll talk about on the next slide. We have various initiatives undertaken to deliver on the strategy, and we have, I think, managed to implement our performance very well. The Auditor General has also commended us on this. However, we do have challenges. As I said, one person in the strategy unit, we've been battling to fill the senior manager enterprise performance management. We have re-advertised the post. And also the maturity level of the organization requires that there's continuous change management intervention. When we come to enterprise risk management, the NTA Exco, headed by the NDPP as the chair, acts as a risk committee for the NPA and is responsible for strategic risk management. We have, as an organization, identified our key risks. The challenge is also here is that it's a one-person show at the moment. We are, however, filling, I think, 8 positions in this particular unit. Internal audit during this period was a challenge. We had to release the head of internal audit, and we did not confirm a probation. And at the time, we decided to explore the feasibility of using a shared service with the Department of Justice. The challenge at the time is that integration took longer than was anticipated. And in hindsight, I'm not sure that we made the right decision because I think we are a bit of a stepchild here. I don't think we get as much attention as I thought we'd be getting. Going back to our strategy 2020, it was adopted in February 2006, and the strategy rests on 3 pillars, namely governance, delivery, and resourcing. The strategy is sustained through annual plans, and I think this is partly answering your question that you have asked. We have strategic initiatives, projects, and a medium-term strategic framework. The objectives of the strategy are reflected in a strategic map, which is on the next slide, and this map sets out the impacts and outcomes and strategic objectives for the NPA. The performance in the NPA is in line with Strategy 2020 and is monitored on a quarterly basis through business unit and NPA performance review sessions. The NPA has established an enterprise performance management committee made up of the CEO, senior management, and is chaired by the national director. It critically reviews organizational performance. So we do have our quarterly performances held regularly, and there's rigorous interrogation where business units haven't met their targets or are not complying with whatever it is they said they would in their plan. We have taken note, however, of the committee's concern that we don't have a clear plan, and we are addressing this. That is our strategy map that I have referred to previously. And then integrity management, which is DPO's baby here, is that integrity culture assessment for the NPA was conducted in all business units. Given the nature of the work of the NPA, a leadership program was implemented, which included integrity as a key performance area. We do know that in terms of the public service administration, integrity was a CMC, another key performance area. But given the nature of our work in the NPA, we decided that it should become a key performance area. So it's now incorporated into all contracts for all NPA senior management. Integrity resource manual to support managers and integrity is a standing item on management meetings. 503 employees trained on ethics. 180 integrity champions recruited and trained. Compliance framework and index developed and used to monitor compliance within the NPA. Organizational conduct was analyzed in the areas of labor relations, recruitment, and attrition. Individual profiling was performed on 182 senior managers. The challenges, however, in this unit are that there is still limited capacity, so this results in less than a quarter of employees trained on ethics issues. In our communications division, the highlights for the year was that we did reach a broader sector on education and raise awareness of the NPA and its work. I know that the committee has been asking how do we sell ourselves, basically. We are trying. Our constraints, as you will see, was that it's a very small unit. It still is. We did also manage to complete our brand audit. And the next stage will be the development of the brand to update the NPA brand and institutionalize corporate identity. We were aware that everyone was using a different logo. Everyone wanted to call themselves this and that. And I think at, when the DSO was started, it was intentional for it to be branded in the manner in which it was branded. It has, however, overshadowed the NPA as an organization, but it is something that we are working on. In our information management, I think the highlights are that we don't have phishing. We even catch out managers who visit porn sites and have been dealt with by the previous national director. We have developed and implemented the first of the planned electronic case management systems for the asset forfeiture unit. We've established a network operations center, followed by the implementation of RADIA and OpenView. Implementation of desktop backup tools, introduced the electronic document management system, which we are extending to the region. Close working relationships have been established with partners in the criminal justice system. We have been doing very well here and have been receiving quite large sums of money from the criminal justice system to assist us with our IT. There are, however, a number of challenges, and as you will see, the first three challenges relate mainly to CETA, delays by CETA and other service providers in finalizing contracts dependent on CETA for the transversal systems that we use in government, the inoperability of safety nets due to CETA hosting it on behalf of National Treasury. So that is a real core area for us. Office space within our headquarters and within the regions for our document management is also a big challenge for us. In the security and risk management, which currently DPO acts in, we were able to work closely with NIA and finalize 90% of what was termed problematic files. These are your vetting files that I'm referring to. vetting investigations conducted to get exposed persons that had illegally acquired South African citizenships. We picked these up. We dealt with the people. We were able to provide a secure and risk-free environment for prosecutors when we were required to. During this period, we only had one prosecutor harmed, and the target here is zero harm for our employees. The challenges also here are that we need to strengthen the relationships with the National Intelligence Agency to ensure quicker turnaround times on vetting of our personnel. In the research and policy information unit, the highlights are that we commenced second crime and criminal justice survey for the NPA, monitoring and evaluation of strategic initiatives to determine the impact thereof. These are the initiatives that came from our strategy 2020. Our library has embarked on the collection of building initiative books to the value of 1.7 million for audit, including a lot of management books. We did realize that we put people into management, but we did not assist them. So our library has quite a number of useful books on management. We also, as we said last week, provide legal books for prosecutors. When each prosecutor is appointed, we give them the four basic legal books. So even where there are no libraries that they can access, they have at least the four basic books that can assist them to prepare for a case. They can log on to our intranet, which has your UTIS set and your LexisNexis. And the challenges here, however, are that we still have to implement the library management system. In our finance and procurement division, which I'm sure the CFO will talk more to, we have installed what is very useful, is a vehicle tracking system. We have also cleared 15 million arrears with the government garage. And the vehicle tracking system works very well. I know that Willie loves checking where his people are. So it's a very useful tool also for managers. We know when people speed, we know where they put in petrol, when they are using, where they are using the garage card for buying cold drinks at the petrol shop. So we can pick up all those little things. And then we also know that the car has dispersed 74 million for the first time. Debt management, I'll leave that for the CEO to talk about. And we had lots of nightmares with the previous travel agent. We appointed a new one. Not that there are no nightmares, but I think slight improvement on the previous one. And then there's been a lot of saving with this new vehicle leasing agreement that we entered into. The challenges here are that for 5 years, you are aware that the NPA received an unqualified audit. And it was really disappointing for us to get a qualified audit, but the CFO will talk to how we are going to remedy this. For human resources and development, a special focus was on addressing the reported level of vacancies, and I think my head of HR is quite equipped to answer the questions, even though it's prior to his time. We have some focused interventions embarked on in HR. One, for example, is with response handling. We have automated this, and this enables the NPA to acknowledge receipt of CVs via SMS or email, and I think we're the first department to do this. During this period, we filled 1,012 positions. The vacancy rate for the period was 33%, but as of 15 February, there are 5,578 filled posts compared to the 439 at the period. So there has been some growth. The current vacancy now, we think, is at about 21%. We are busy still filling vacancies at this point in time, so I'm sure by now the figures have changed. We've made significant progress in converting the aspirant prosecutor program into a formal learnership, which will now be a learnership for a year rather than the 6 months aspirants that we currently have. The same will be for the family law learnership.
We've completed 99% of job evaluations, and we have awarded, and we actually encourage people in the NPA to study. We've awarded 275 bursaries this period. We also have an induction program that was developed in this period and is being implemented. We have done all the process mapping for the HR NND functions. We just need to start implementing that. Challenges in this unit are that we are working towards meeting our equity target. However, we've had challenges, especially at management level, and women in particular. We've lost a number of women in the NPA at senior management level. It is getting very difficult to find, because we also find that everybody is under pressure from the Department of Labor to meet their equity. So we have women being offered very lucrative salaries and are leaving for the private sector or other areas. During this period, we did have a very high vacancy rate and staff turnover within HR, and this impeded delivery. Currently, though, as I say, the head of HR has been filled, and he's busy filling his senior management post. He's got one senior manager, and he's busy filling four at the moment. He's advertised, and I think he's currently doing interviews. Other challenges are that the post of the CEO has been vacant since June 2007. It has been advertised. Advocate Boucher has been concerned that the CVs we have received for this post, we are rather disturbed, and I'm not sure if we need to go and headhunt. We only managed to shortlist two people, but even then, we're not too happy. We received about, must have received over 100. But of that, the quality was very, very poor. And we also know that during this time, the CEO, myself, Deputy CEO, and the Head of Integrity, we had a string of anonymous letters sent about us, and from the Public Service Commission was asked by the then National Director, Bulelani Muga, to do the inquiry, because he was also mentioned in these letters. And you know, we had this drawn out disciplinary hearing that took forever. Charges were withdrawn, reinstated again. And, you know, morale was very low, and this is actually during the time that the result of this was, part of the result was this qualified audit that we got. It was during this time. And also during this time, we know that the CFO post was vacant. We had advertised twice, we couldn't find somebody. We had the Justice CFO acting, standing in for us, but also again, I feel that we were the stepchild and not getting full attention. You know, it was, I think, too big a task to be looking at Justice and us. During this time, two several senior managers advocated their posts, and acting appointments were made. And as you realize that this is still the current situation, we have a number of senior people in acting positions. During this period, there were a number of acting incumbents. It was the acting executive manager, HR, CFO, IMSC. But we are in the process of filling the post. The one good thing is that we do have a CFO. We filled that post in October. Thank you.
And then we'll come back to the case.
Thank you, Chairperson. Just while we're waiting for the for Corinne to get the presentation up, I would just have to comment and add to what the acting CEO said about the financial year ending March 2007 and the audit qualification that was had there. We had a number of things adding to the problems of of this surrounding this audit qualification, not least of all was the lack of senior people in virtually all positions that contribute to this matter. Also, we had a National Treasury indecisive about things like asset classifications. In Cairo, for instance, we had a letter from, it was an unsigned letter, but we had a letter from National Treasury telling us that the method of accounting for assets would be the same as the year before. And then at the last minute this was withdrawn, and we got qualified because we hadn't put in the normal asset registers, etc. We have the auditors reporting a finance lease for the VGM building, that is the building that houses the head office of the NTA. This lease was put in place in the year 2000, and it had the blessing of the State Tender Board. It had the blessing of National Treasury. It was classified as a best practice lease. It was copied by other departments. Every possible diligence was taken in setting up this lease. And then in the year ending March 2007, the AG felt it necessary to classify this lease as a finance lease, and it resulted in 81 million rand worth of irregular expenditure. Now it's unfortunate that then had to come about in this financial year. That now has to be, condonement of that has to be requested from Treasury and granted. We also had the RentWorks, our vehicle leasing model, which throughout the implementation of the model, we were engaging with National Treasury, we were engaging with the AG's office, and to all intents and purposes, we were fully convinced of the status of that lease as an operational lease. It then, at the last minute, was classified as a finance lease by the AG, and again resulted in substantial amounts of money as irregular expenditure. So those aspects make the figures of the qualification seem abnormally large, but if one looks at it, the NPA really tried to apply due diligence in saving taxpayers' money. In fact, they did save taxpayers' money. The AG agreed with us that the RentWorks model in 1 year was some 20 million rand cheaper than the previous leasing model that the contract with the Department of Transport through the Imperial Motor Holdings for the same number of vehicles in the same category. So whilst we have got a qualified report, in some instances we actually have saved substantial amounts of money and were able to deliver the service that the NPA has to deliver with a minimal budget. So I like to give that as a background to the actual audit qualification. What we have done, what we put in...
So technically you sort of provided the basis for the AG to say what you did, that you have a qualified report. In effect, you actually saved money. So what you say?
In the case of the lease, of the RentWorks lease, yes, it was classified as a finance lease. That, in terms of Treasury regulations, is not allowed. Okay, the Treasury actually put, following our lease and our engagement, they actually wrote a practice note in December 2006, now allowing finance leases of vehicles because of this issue. Yes. So, but the AG is again saying our lease was entered into before the practice notice was issued, and that was the situation. But what we have done since October, since my appointment as the CFO, we've also formalized the appointment of two very important senior managers, one of supply chain management, one of our finance operations. They are now appointed. We have a full complement of senior managers in the unit. We have an action plan and progress report, which I think I need to give you, of the NPA and the CORA audit qualifications and what is our progress to date.
Our oversight, how you manage the budget allocated to you.
Yes.
We'd like that.
Yes. Okay. I'll give that to you. But just to say that one of the main areas of qualification was on the assets. And we immediately put into, you know, we went out to tender, we got a service provider in, and they are busy as we are meeting here. They're busy every day counting, tagging all the assets of the MPA around the country. They are going back through 5 years of invoices to get costs into place. That job is about 80% complete now, and all indications are that they will complete this job by the 31st of March. So a big portion of the problem in the MPA audit last year will be addressed in that manner. Other areas that were quite serious with us, areas like debt management. I know that for the last, every year that EPA has come to Skopa, it's been 3 years now, this debt has risen. This year, we will, for the first time, show a decrease, and a substantial decrease in the debt management. So there is going to be a dramatic improvement in that area that we are collecting the debt. And not only that, we've put into place measures to stop the debt growing, to stop further debt accruing. One of the big contributors to the debt growth in the NPA was cell phone abuse by officials. And our new cell phone policy very definitely puts cell phone usage in the hands of the employee. We will no longer carry the debt for the employee, so their own bank accounts will be debited by any excesses on the cell phone usage. So that is a big step forward. So not only will it not grow, we are taking steps to recover the balance. Okay, so that if I may leave the audit with the proviso that you will be forwarded a copy of our action plan and the progress report, and then I'll just skip through some of the financial slides. First one is the 2006-07 financial overview, and the final appropriation figures that we have there include the extra allocations we got from Department of Justice, and unfortunately they were in the last month of the financial year, in the month of March, which again posed a problem for us in trying to get that spent in the right manner. The fact that the actual expenditure in for instance, compensation of employees exactly equals the final appropriation is because we've varimented expenditure down in terms of the regulations to cover excesses in goods and services. The variance there of 49 million, that was repaid to Treasury this year, and that relates to in the main expenditure for Imperial Motor Holdings, which is the case that's still pending in that regard. That case has gone to, it hasn't gone to formal arbitration, but we are using an informal arbitrator to try and see if we can resolve that case at the moment. The budget split for 2006-07 is there. It shows a 31.8% portion for goods and services. This is more like what we should be getting, we have a constant problem of when Treasury allocates to us a allocation like they did to give us money for two prosecutors per court, they give it all into the compensation of employees category, and then there's no portion allowed for the support services that need to support those new employees. And there we've had to environment back to the goods and services category. First sub-unit, again I'm going to skip through these because they all show the same picture where we've environmented monies and only the variance for the Imperial Motor Holdings is less. All the rest was spent. Can we just click through those, if you don't mind? And then we'll come to the 2007-08 budget overview. Here we have the projected expenditure to March, which shows that we're almost on target to spend our budget. We know that Justice have again got major underspending in this financial year, so they have been requesting us to see if we can take up any money. I'm very loath to take any money and certainly not in the last month of the year, because it just creates audit problems for us. And yes. So... That's good. Okay, the next slide just again. Yeah. But Chairperson, the problem is that the problem that faces the MPA, and I'm going to be quite frank here, is that National Treasury have